9 o'clock.
Oh, 9 o'clock. Sorry. It's 9 o'clock. No, I'm fine. Other members, good morning. Also good morning and welcome to Co-Chair Ivan Forza, a joint meeting of the Select Committee for Appropriations and the Standing Committee for Appropriations. Welcome to the stakeholders that are here, a very important session. Why? Because we are getting inputs on the division of revenue. You've got the agenda in front of you. We're going to give the stakeholders 35 minutes to do their presentations because there are six of them. And some of our members will start leaving early to catch the flights connecting to provinces like Limpopo, Mpumalanga, etc. So we'll have to bear that in mind. Are there any apologies, Select Committee for Appropriations, Estelle? Notara and Gaila, noted. Apologies from the Standing Committee on Appropriations.
Sorry.
None?
Honourable
Issa?
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Dion and George will join us later. He's just head up again to another meeting.
Yeah, no, fine. They must not join us. And catch up with us.
Chair? Sorry?
Yes, Honourable McCaffrey?
No, as you said, I would like to leave at 1 o'clock if we're not done by then. But just as a comment, sir, I think it's highly inappropriate for whoever designed this program to put so much on for such a short period of time. It's not showing respect to those members of the public that come, bother to come present to us and engage in what we call public participation. I'm a little disappointed with our performance here. I don't think this is right.
What is your proposal, Honourable McLaughlin?
Well, it's a little late now, sir, but we should have sent it for a full day's meeting. But I know that would inconvenience a lot of people, so we can't do that now. But perhaps we should reschedule part of this meeting that we don't get through today for Monday or something like that, because there's not a lot of time left for us. Thank you, sir.
Co-Chair Porter, do you want to make an input on this?
Okay, thank you very much. Good morning, honoured members. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think honoured member McLaughlin's concern is fair, but to say that we should maybe do part of this today and then the other part on Monday, to me it has got cost implications. Maybe in future, you're right, we should divide it into, or we give it a full day, not on, we don't put it on a Friday. But I'm sure members understand. Thank you very much for your understanding. So in future, we will find a better way of managing this. Thanks for raising your concern.
Thank you, ma'am.
The Moneyballs Act has been amended to give more space for a situation like this. You're right. We must actually have a full day. But the NA will rise on the 20th of March. That's the reality. So we have to complete jointly what we can as soon as possible. That's the reason that meetings are shortened sometimes and people are uncomfortable with the time allocated to do presentations. I understand it 100%. And we share the same view that we need more time for this. Yes. Thank you, honourable members. The FFC is here. We're going to put Professor Blakey's on with his team immediately. You received the documentation. It was mailed to you, Professor Blakey.
Good morning, Chair, and honourable members, colleagues. Chair, can I just introduce the team with me?
Yes.
Sitting next to me is Commissioner Sipho Mbisi. And then on my left is Indira Kabe, some of our researchers. Behind him is Henry Eckstein, our parliamentary officer. Right behind me is Dr. Mkuli Mbube, one of our researchers, and such a fetus. So, if you come from Fetan, there's such a we will try to help you with any time, but I think when we get the opportunity in the sixth parliament, we will request both from you and from this committee, from this committee, to give us more time, especially when we start dealing with the appropriations.
Agreed.
Because as a constitutional institution, we have a lot to advise about the budget to put together, but also our appropriation
yes.
is to be doubtful. And contrary to the views that has been expressed, also at different ways to how things could be done in relation to the budget framework. Notwithstanding, this presentation will cover the 2009 budget overview, the macroeconomic environmental assessment. We look at specifically the FFC's response to the region of revenue growth. In there, we're looking at what government's response to the FFC recommendations are. And then we give like specific pointers as to what we agree with as it relates to the changes in the fiscal framework, provincial framework, and also the local government.
Yeah.
On the next slide, it's just to confirm the President has raised these priorities, so obviously you need to check the policy in the region of revenue against these policy priorities. The President has raised five policy priorities: accelerating inclusive economic growth and job creation, improving the education system with a view to developing current and future skills required for national growth and development, improving the conditions for life for all of South Africans, especially the poor, fighting corruption and state capture, and sending capacity of the state to address the needs of the people. On all of that, all of these, we do have a set of recommendations that we've made over the years, but in particular last year, on our own recommendations on the vision of revenue submissions. On the macro overview, government consistently has revised its economic growth projections and downward since 2009 as the economy has struggled to recover. We know we struggle with economic growth and development, and as a result, it has been difficult because of the global and domestic financial crises. In fact, we're still experiencing the flow of previous financial meltdowns. But also the whole question about commodity prices and bonds from other countries in South Africa. We have muted economic growth forecasts, inflation remaining at the upper bound of the target 3% to 6% range. And as I've mentioned, it's a fragile domestic and export demand, of course, in particular because of commodity demands. The fiscal framework and the division of revenue. There's a revenue shortfall of 16.3 billion over the next 3 years. This necessitates significant expenditure prioritization. Growth in debt and debt service costs have grown consistently into the public since 2009, and threatened to crowd out economic and social spending. The financially stressed state-owned enterprises pose huge risk to the fiscus. We've had many discussions in the different committees about the credit of ESCOM and other institutions with regard to government guarantees and the consequences of that. On the economic and fiscal outlook, we want to confirm South Africa's economic prospects have deteriorated, despite its fiscal spending continues to exceed revenue. So we see a real long-term growth continues to decelerate. We have seen the system scales, negative outlooks by credit rating agencies we've experienced over the years, institutional deterioration due to government's failure, the number of commissions that's in place that the President has instituted, and also investigations, through the special investigations unit, is indicative of what's happening in our institutions. The uncertainty causing structural degeneration of both the demand and supply side of the economy, and as mentioned, financial, operational, government issue crisis of especially the strategic set of enterprises is continuously a matter of concern. We're experiencing subdued current trends and expected demand, especially around private consumption growth contribution, which slowed from quarter 4 2017 at 1% to 0.8% in quarter 3 of 2018 due to a readjustment of the business cycle. You see, government consumption growth contribution sustained at 0.3% for 3 quarters for the 2018 year. Public investment growth contribution slowed down from 0.3% at the beginning of the same year to 0.1% in the third quarter. Private investment remained in negative territory, declining at 0.1% due to the subdued economic outlook and expected future demand is falling. After the negative inventory carry in quarter 2 of 2018, firms began restocking again, adding 0.8% growth contribution in quarter 3. And finally, external demand for net export increased significantly by minus 1.1% in quarter 3 of 2018. On the fiscal constraint side, since the 2009 financial crisis, national revenue and expenditure trends have departed into distinct divergence. Fiscal contractionary measures implemented over 3 years, by governments imposing their expenditure ceiling, we've seen it over the last 3 years, consolidating spending through cost containment measures, raising of marginal income tax from 40% to 45% in the highest income bracket in 2017-18. We've seen an increase last year in particular of VAT from 14% to 15%. And we also witnessed the cutting of the air conditioner grants. These measures have been insufficient to close, obvious that this is insufficient to close the widening gap between total revenue and expense. With the economy locked into low growth spiral with rising deficit, it's evident that the current trajectory of spending will need further moderation. So it's obvious basically that there's going to be a need for further tight belting going forward. There's going to be a need to look at efficiency gains in certain spending areas. There's also going to be a need for much more tighter monitoring on the spending, especially through the appropriations of the different departments. And possible reprioritization, a much more stringent, stronger push for reprioritization in different areas. So yeah, I just wanted to give over to Eddie immediately to go through our responses in this area. Sorry, Sasha.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair.
I'm Professor Matthew
Atakari. I'm the next slide summarizes technical changes to the 2019 Division of Revenue Bill, along with the NFC views on each of the changes. So the first adjustment concerns the addition of two clauses 9 subsection 4 and 10 subsection 11. And this addition of these clauses is about ensuring more accountability in our transfer system. Previously, the DOR Act imposed responsibilities only on the grant transferring and receiving officers and not on other departments mentioned in the grant framework. So these two new additions are about now also holding these other departments mentioned in the grant framework responsible. So the FSC welcomes the addition of these clauses as we think it will assist in ensuring greater collaboration by departments, which will hopefully result in more effective management of grants. The next change is a revision to an existing clause, clause 10 subsection 6b. And this clause is revised to extend the time frame within which transferring departments of specific purpose grants second the time that these transferring departments have to submit financial information. So instead of 15 days, departments will now have 20 days to submit, and the MSC agrees with this revision, as we believe that this additional time may possibly help to result in better quality performance information, performance and financial information being reported. Then moving to the last row on that slide, a new clause, slide 17, subsection 3 is added. And essentially, this addition requires that where the receiving officer of a grant is going to transfer grant funds to another organization, there should be a formal agreement between the two, and that proof of such an agreement be submitted to the National Treasury and Transferring Department. Again, the MSC supports the addition of this clause as it emphasizes the use of service level agreements, which is important for accountability and will also help in eliminating issues of unfunded mandates and duplication. Moving to the next slide, slide 10. The next change is also a revision to an existing clause, clause 26, subsection 3, and it is about allowing COGSTA and the Department of Human Settlements to release disaster-related funding to a province or municipality within the period specified in the Disaster Management Act. We welcome this change as it allows for more immediate response to disaster situations within the confines of the Disaster Management Act. Then another new clause, 27.2b, is added to the Division of Revenue. This clause requires transferring departments to first consult with the receiving department before submitting the grant framework to National Treasury. So this is something that happens in the planning phase before finalization of grants of the Division of Revenue. And we think this is a good, the inclusion of this clause is good as it allows for responsibilities of departments to be clarified as well as designing an effective grant framework. Moving to the next slide, slide 11. Another new clause, clause 25.5c, is added, which requires COGSTA to get National Treasury approval when it comes to new, additional, or non-qualifying municipalities in respect of the Integrated Urban Development Grant, and that is a new grant that is introduced this year for non-major cities, and which aims to promote greater spatial integration. Now, the MSC does not agree with the inclusion of this clause, and I think that's the only clause that the MSC does not agree with. And our view is that the department responsible for the grant, COGSTA, should be allowed to manage the process. Of course, such management must be guided by the conditional grant framework. If we move to the next slide, slide 12. Now, in terms of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, government must publish its response to the FFC's recommendations annually when it tables the budget. And the purpose of this slide is just to appraise members of that response. And we will recall that the MSC's annual submission for the 2019-20 Division of Revenue contains six chapters with a total of 21 recommendations. And the National Treasury responds to the recommendations on behalf of government. And those responses are in respect of recommendations that are deemed to be either directly or indirectly related to the Division of Revenue. So we have responses to 12 of the 21 recommendations. So there were 12 recommendations that were deemed to be directly or indirectly related to the Division of Revenue. The balance which are not related to the Division of Revenue are being considered by the relevant national departments. But I think the key message we wanted to convey is that government agrees with the majority of the FFC's recommendations. And what we are pleased to see is that in some cases where government agrees, there's also now more detail being provided as to how these are going to be implemented. And then for members interested in the responses, we've attached as part of the administrative document each recommendation as well as whether they've been responded to or not.
just before he proceeds, honourable members, the presentation of the FFC, page 9, or slide 9 to 11, must be read together with the Division of Revenue presentation, which it did yesterday. That was done by the Treasury. It must be read together.
Thank you, Chef. My honourable members, I'm going to take you through the remaining five FFP presentations, so I'll be covering the Chinese specific framework. So just to give an overview of the official framework and the commission observation, so what we'd like to note here is that the non-interest expenditure is set to grow by about 2% and grow over the next 3 years. From the commission's perspective, I think that is a welcome development. Covers the cost of compensation. But I mean the government does not only deal with compensation only. There are also other input costs, especially in the aspect of seeing cost rising by almost more than the inflation. And so the 2% real growth is not really covered. So it may affect the credit going forward. With respect to your conditional grant, so what we feel is that conditional grant continue to bear the brand of consolidation, which again is the cost of local. So the implications of what's going forward is that we may likely to see some of our national priorities being undermined because conditions are not as conditional grants are based on the allocations are being revised quite effectively. With respect to changes to the provincial fiscal framework, I think what is noted there is that the province will be allocated about 1.9 trillion right over the medium term provincial framework. What we note is that what is the policy development with respect to the PES, especially, is that we started to see some of the conditional grants were introduced later, I mean before, and now reached the end of their life, they are not being integrated into the provincial distribution, into the provincial distribution. But as and when that happens, what we caution against is that during the transition, the transition must be accompanied by greater oversight of this transfer to ensure that those priorities are not necessarily crowded out by some of other provincial cases in priority. Again, we also note that the provincial social allocation will maintain a nominal component of about 7.2% of the medium-term expenditure. And what also welcome is that we're starting to see less and less priorities associated with additions to the provincial intervention formula. That allows provinces to focus on key and core expenditure competencies. But what we advise is that expenditure management should be exercised to manage the impact of cost escalation on the economy due to low increase in the provincial distribution So as I mentioned, conditional grants continue to be the largest grant for consolidation with a projected reduction of 5 billion rent over the 2019 medium-term expenditure. So the Commission stands, of course, we agree with the reduction in conditional grants, especially where we find that some of the conditional grants are underperforming. But again, what we're saying is that the readjustment in the conditional grants should not temper with approved delivery plan. So when there is a reduction in the key provincial conditional grants or local government conditional grants, that is also consider the fact that some municipalities may have or provinces may have planned ahead in respect of their expenditure plan, and that should be protected. Moving to the conditional grants, what we know, there have been a number of changes within the provincial conditional grants. And in the main, we note here that the comprehensive agriculture support program, which has been reduced by about 837 million, and this fund is being prioritized and transferred to the lender for the implementation of the blended finance mechanism. So the Commission supports this reprioritization, but we would like to see more involvement in provinces in this kind of involved in how this funding is ultimately redistributed, because there are also equity considerations when funding is obviously, when funding is under control of conditional entities, there are considerations that we need to be careful of equity considerations, especially among the different provinces. So that is a welcome development. With respect to the human settlement development grant, we're noting a reduction of 3 billion over the 2019 medium-term expenditure framework. years it's been reduction, especially related to the human development development plan. So what it means essentially is that the number of RTP houses that is being delivered through this grant over the years has been declining and declining. And when you factor in the cost escalation in the built environment and also consider the this reduction, so it's ultimately been cost our target delivery in respect of RTP houses will also be prolonged. So it will take us more time to reach some of those targets. With respect to HSDG, we're also noting that where the about 7.4 billion has been really prioritized over the medium term expenditure framework to implement e-commerce settlement upgrading program. So what we know over time was that this program was supposed to have been part of the HSDG, but it appears that municipalities have not been really fast tracking this program, and now we've been government trying to earmark funding for HSDG. So what is of concern to the Commission here is that earmarking limits provincial discretion. So and what we have also noted over time in our previous submission was that some of these centralized or indirect conditional grants do not necessarily perform as well as those conditional grants which are being implemented by government. We also noticed that as part of the regulation process, it is anticipated that the public transport contracting and regulatory function could be assigned to metropolitan municipalities during 2019-20 financial year. And as a result, 2018 will be transferred directly to the public municipalities. Again, this is a welcome development. The Commission made a recommendation a while ago regarding the need for integrated planning within the metro space. So with the devolution of the transportation function to the metro, we'll start to see more and more integrated transportation systems. And you may have seen in certain cities, you find that there are different transportation networks, different types of buses moving the same direction, but not necessarily integrated. So with this evolution, we're more likely to see more integrated transportation. The new development in the health sector is the introduction of the human resource capacitation grant to assist the departments of health for address critical vacant posts in the health facilities. So as a commission, we support the introduction of this grant as the human resources is the key to functioning of the health facilities, and this will address the shortages in the public sector. The point we'd like to highlight here is that, especially with respect to the NHI grant, is that over the years, what we've seen that there seems to be a lot of prioritization within the health sector. And as and when there are new policy priorities within the health sector, they are down to the NHI grant. So the question now is everything in are all priorities within the health sector necessarily associated with the NHI? So the question here is, we need to be clear about what the NHI grant is supposed to be achieved and make sure that the policy priorities which are associated with the grant, that this assists us towards getting closer to the implementation of the NHI. So you don't just overburden the grant with too many objectives, then it loses focus. The Commission also notes the additional 2.8 billion allocated to the school infrastructure development grant for the replacement of digital teams as well as the provide water in school. Again, this grant has been introduced. This grant was first introduced in 2011. We still sit here today with the school bedrock not having been addressed. Even when this grant was introduced, it was introduced with about a 3-year timeline, but we're sitting 5-8 years later. The grant is still there and the growth has not been addressed. So from our perspective is that in the analysis of the infrastructure value chain reveals that there is a level of infrastructure oversight at key delivery points, which are actually increasing the incentive to engage in fiscal misappropriation. Chairperson,
can we just go back to the health sector? You added the sentence, this grant has too many, and then I lost it.
Objectives.
Too many objectives. Okay?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. With respect to the local government fiscal framework, again, what we notice is that the local government allocated 414 billion over the 2019 medium-term expenditure framework. And when we get the composition of the local government transfer, we note that the local government share remains the largest transfer, and that is a welcome development. Over time, of course, we want to see more and more can't be integrated into the local government as and when the system matures. And in nominal terms, the local government allocation will grow modestly by 8.4% over the medium term expenditure. Chair President, you may have seen that yesterday the NERSA approved about a 9.7% electricity increase for ESCOM. And with the 8.4% nominal increase on the total share, this means that additional pressure on, especially the delivery of free basic services at municipal level. So it means that municipalities are going to have to really reprioritize to make sure that they cover the cost of the 9% that has been granted by NERSA yesterday to ESCOM. In real terms, the growth of local government allocation over the next 3 years is positive, 3% on average over the medium term. So that is a welcome development. Moving on to the local government commissioner grant, what we also noted is that during the medium term expenditure, net 2019 medium term expenditure permit, the local government commissioner grant will be structured by introducing new grants, prioritizing funding, and consolidating some of the grants. So there will be no grant which is called the Interstate Development Grant to be introduced for non-metro cities with the purpose of promoting partial integration and greater leveraging of the non-transportation system. So when you look at the development between the IUDG as well as the evolution of the transportation fund, I think we can say things for what the local government is from going forward. So the Commission supports the introduction of this grant as it is in line with its previous recommendation that the grant should follow a differentiated allocation. Again, the structure of the public transportation is also being reversed by introducing an incentive element to the grant. The Commission has made previous recommendations around the incentives. Moving forward to, again, we also noticed that the USDG would also conspire to on slide 23. Yes. The USDG will be advised to incorporate the integrated national electrification program grant for metros. Again, the Commission welcomes the measure of the two grants that will provide a basis for a holistic approach to building university. So with this particular one, chapter and one of the members, what we'd like to highlight is that we have seen a whole lot of problems associated with islands in certain cases where the municipalities will be granted an IDEP allocation and build infrastructure, and upon completing that infrastructure, they hand it over, which is an income generating asset. They hand it over to ESCOM, and obviously that creates pressure on the municipality on their ability to raise revenue through the sales of electricity. Of course, this kind of development should be accompanied by the reforms to make sure that some of the municipalities with this licensing for get licensing for the distribution or circulation of electricity, depending on whether they have capacity to do that. Just to the two last final slides, the president mainly speaks to the sector and economic protection function, as well as protection function. So in this case, the Commission will come to 4% average growth in social protection expenditure, because obviously it's pushing social beneficiaries is critical in the compensation of poor for the assets and emanating from government training structure in general and consolidation fiscal adjustment system. So the social protection program therefore plays a pivotal role in alleviating poverty and disability through the protection of social. Again, the Commission supports the government introducing a resource provider in the delivery of grants and minimizing intermediation costs and also as well as enhancing efficiency in special spending. Lastly, the Commission also commends government for the contribution of 100 billion to a better financing infrastructure fund over the next year, because more land with more than affordable infrastructure will greatly enhance our infrastructure and benefit for both businesses and citizens. I think the point we're really making here is that what we have noted and what we're also starting to know in some of the recommendations will come in the next Commission recommendations is that the infrastructure delivery program is characterized by quite a lot of management efficiency and with the introduction of this blended financing structure. So we are more likely to see improvements in project management, especially at the municipal level and the stay on the Apache. So we know that it is much more benefit associated with the infrastructure of the program. Chairperson, with your permission, I'd like to hand over to our information specialist to just conclude the presentation.
Yes, proceed.
Chair, so we focused very firmly on the division of revenue, and in particular how the different transfers, whether it's equitable share allocation, whether it's conditional ground allocation, is made in the 2019 division of revenue report. So we have the view that the new measures introduced to improve governance and performance of conditional grounds, we agree with that. And we also agree with the general thrust, given the economic and fiscal environment we found ourselves in, the general thrust of the division of revenue. So the Commission recognizes then that government has managed to maintain real growth in the allocation of resources to these three spheres under difficult economic circumstances. The Commission reiterated the need for greater oversight over provincial and municipal spending. But it's also got to do with how account financial accounting takes place within the different departments, and whether there's an adequate system of peer review of performance between different departments within the province, but also between province and national, and within municipalities. So we think there's one thing about talking about oversight, but there's another thing to work out with the nuts and bolts of oversight and responsibility and accountability that needs to be taken. And it's not only about rules. It's also whether people understand the internal dynamics of how rules need to be applied and double-checked on it. The Commission has noted the reduction in the funding of provincial conditional grants. Obviously, as a consequence of lack of fiscal space, as well as the restructuring, but I said that it was partly the function was a consequence of the fiscal crisis. In local government, it is recognized that allocations are expected to grow modestly. Here, attention should be paid to greater efficiency of spending. But also, just to raise, to connect with the point that Eddie has made, on the electricity matter. There's a need to look at costing and pricing of electricity within the municipality. You will find in many of those municipalities that are struggling that they charge the same cost to their customers as to what Eskom charges them. That's the one aspect of it. And as a result, there's no consideration of the pass-through cost from purchasing the electricity from Eskom to the end user. That's the one thing. The other thing is that what is found is that the invoicing that's happening in municipalities is also a concern. And in some municipalities we'll probably start seeing that the collection of the lack of, because people are going to alternative energy sources, electricity is no longer the main income for some of the municipalities. As a result, you'll see in certain municipalities, especially metros, that there's a continuous move towards increasing property taxes. And that's a matter that I think this committee needs to, the two committees needs to be aware of. The Commission applauds the government's continuing efforts to reduce poverty, to maintain the increase in social grants and other forms of social protection programs in health and education. And in the same vein, the Commission is of the view that the allocations for economic development is welcome. Okay, that concludes our inputs and our review, and it's, as I said to you, this time around it will be more specific to the division of revenue. Thank you.
Thank you to the FFC, all the members, Select Committee on Appropriations. I call on the members that you forward this to your chairs of the finance committees in the legislatures. This presentation by the FFC and the next one to follow by Shalko. It would have been helpful if the FFC, if possible, could have attended the briefings in the legislators, but it might be a logistic nightmare. But that's future. That's where my mind is there already, thinking about that. But I'll speak to you after the meeting. Salga, thank you for your presentation to the FFC. We'll take it further, Salga.
Thank you very much, Chapter Friend.
I'm going to give you 30 minutes as well.
Honorable members. I'm Candida T. M. Charles. I'm an interviewer from Salga from Maranda. I'm here with Khomotso Piso and Tabane Lekheta. With your permission, I'll hand over to Takane Lekheta to do the comments. Thank you, Chair.
Just before you start, a good lady, Western Cape Forum for Intellectual Disability, are they here? I just want to see who's here. Equal Education, are you here? Yeah, why are you sit so far? Rural Health Advocacy Project? No. Budget Justice Coalition? No. Thank you. Sorry for this. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honourable members of the committee. I'm going to take you through the comments from SALGA with regard to the Division of Revenue Bill. And on, as a form of introduction, SALGA is fulfilling its mandate of lobbying and advocating for local government. And it participated in the budget forum that was held in September last year. That contributed to the crafting of the medium-term budget policy statement as required. SALGA also contributed in the consolidation of what became the 2019 Division of Revenue Bill through our mandatory comments on the bill. The technical canvassing of the issues between National Treasury, COPTA, the FFC, and SALGA does assist in clarifying issues, even though we do not necessarily agree on everything. As a bit of a background, Chair, the 2018 medium-term budget policy statement reaffirmed the government's commitment to fiscal sustainability and debt stabilization without introducing fiscal measures that could limit economic growth. The medium-term expenditure framework therefore focused on maintaining the budget ceiling by reprioritizing funds to support the President's economic stimulus and recovery package, avoiding increases in major tax instruments, and retaining compensation ceilings. In general, Chair, the 2019 budget aims to be redistributive despite new spending pressures and reductions effected to departmental baseline. 68% of the consolidated expenditure targeted towards education, health, social grants, and basic services. The 2019 budget, however, proposes an increase to the expenditure ceiling to make a provision for the proposed reconfiguration of ESCOM. The contingency reserve has also been increased to make provision for fiscal support requests for small state-owned companies. With regard to the 2019 budget amounts to 1.7 trillion. And is expected to increase to 1.9 trillion by 2021-22. The national allocation accounts for 65.4% share of the total revenue rate through the fiscal. This is followed by provinces' allocation of 30% and local government with a share of only 4.2%. The 2019-20 national equitable share amounts to 41%, considering the contingency reserve debt, services cost, and provincial and local government conditional transfers. While the provinces share increases to 43% and the local government share is at 8.9%. Local government equitable share of nationally raised revenue growth is 9.1% on average over the medium term expenditure framework compared to the national allocation of 6.9%. And provincial allocation growth is at 7%. The very low baseline of local government since early 2000s should be taken into account, and I will expand further on this shortly. The conditional fund transfer to local government amounts to 52.4 billion in 2019-20 and increases to 55.3 billion and 60.3 billion in the two outer years. Over the medium-term expenditure framework, local government conditional fund transfer grew at a nominal average rate of 7.3%, which partly offsets the large growth in the local government equitable share. A new integrated urban development grant is introduced in 2019, specifically targeting urban local municipalities, as highlighted also by the FFC. A window amounting to 20% of the urban settlement development grant is introduced for the upgrading of informal settlements, and 318.5 million to the indirect component of the regional bulk infrastructure grant. The Department of Water and Sanitation has placed a moratorium on new projects funded through the regional bulk infrastructure grant. Moving to the state of local government finances, Chair. Local government finances are in distress, as evidenced by the following. 128 of the 257 municipalities are in financial distress at the end of 2016-17 financial year, according to National Treasury's State of Local Government report. 145 municipalities achieved an unqualified audit report by 2016-17 financial year, and which the Office of the Auditor General noted as a continued pattern of deterioration. 40 municipalities had negative cash balances as at end of 17-18 financial year. Revenue collection rates have declined, with the municipal debt age profile specifically 90 days and above. And the latest Section 71 report published by National Treasury shows that the latest debt owed to municipalities is 184.7 billion as at 31st December 2018. This then affects the municipal financial position negatively and increases the debt owed by municipalities to Eskom and water boards as penalties are incurred. While the number of municipalities adopting unfunded budgets increased from 83 municipalities in 17-18 financial year to 113 in the 2018-19 financial year. Now, Chair, in the past, FALCA would come to the committee to voice concerns that local government is unfunded without facts. But this time around, Chair, we are here with facts from the research study which was conducted and revealed that local government is underfunded in the current fiscal year in an amount approximately 55 billion. And this is made of operating expenditure, which is 35 billion, and is made up of maintenance deficits, unfunded mandates, and underfunding of basic services delivery for the equitable share. And also the capital expenditure, which makes 20 billion underfunding compared to consolidated budget. We are also view that this gap can be filled by a combination of the following: a higher allocation of nationally raised revenue to local government, restructuring conditional funds to make them more flexible and to cater for maintenance of infrastructure, review of municipal demarcation to focus on financial viability instead of just making municipalities concerted campaign to reduce distribution losses, which is a big issue in local government. Restructuring the short learning program in municipal governments to advance the development and local government agenda. National incentives to enforce commercial customers to settle their debt. The reduction of the reporting and or compliance burden on local governments, removing ESCOM from the municipal electricity distribution market, as the FFC has also recommended, addressing confusion over the respective powers and functions between local governments and other types of governments, and also encouraging government departments to settle their outstanding debts with local governments. Because, as I said, of that 184 billion, 9.8 billion is attributable to government. Now, further view on the division of revenue bill in terms of the conceptual framework as follows. An underlying premises about sustainable equilibrium in the fiscal framework that applies to local government. Occurs when in a long-term balance, there's a long-term balance between functions and responsibilities on one hand, and also the financial resource muscle on the other. In 1998, the 1998 white paper envisaged the situation of long-term equilibrium facilitated by the notion of the equitable share, which would make up the shortfall between obligations and municipal own financial resources. This concept of local government equitable share meant that financial viability was never the number one criteria for demarcation. Now, the white paper was based on a number of assumptions around the new structure of local government. And the critical question is how much has changed since 1998, and does this warrant a complete revision of the white paper? We believe the answer to that question is a resounding yes, as further. Now, the review of the white paper assumptions that local government could raise in aggregate 90% of its own revenue. There was little empirical evidence during that time to support this, given that the current structure of local government did not exist and key data input. Most of that money would be raised through property taxes and the sale of services, especially electricity. In 1998, South Africa had one of the cheapest bulk electricity prices in the world. Property taxes would be extended to rural areas. Municipalities would be able to raise additional funding through a range of borrowing and alternative financing options. Municipalities would retain the right to electricity disconnections as a key means of debt management. The local government equitable share would enable municipalities to deliver a basic package of services to all low-income and indigent households in that area. Now, the white paper was silent on how exactly a situation such as the one local government currently finds itself in was to be addressed. What would be the cost of action if the amount of money required in transfers to make local government financial sustainable was simply not available? When it comes to hotel services, we believe that a distinct approach should be adopted. Sure. The 2018-19 municipal health services audit conducted by Southern has highlighted challenges, some of which could be contributing to the current situation. Municipal health services is not receiving priority when it comes to allocation of budget as compared to other municipal services. Yet, this is an essential service which could lead to loss of life and burden of diseases if not rendered. The current equitable share allocation to district and metropolitan municipalities for municipal health and related services is 9.31 cents per household per month. Not much of this allocation gets transferred to municipalities given the revenue adjustment sector. The local government equitable share allocation for municipal health services allows for allocation to be channeled to other services. The National Environmental Health Policy of 2003 and the WHO guidelines provide for the appointment of at least one environmental health practitioner for every 10,000 population for provision of environmental health services or municipal health services in the case of local government. Municipal health services starting at local government currently has a backlog of approximately 70%, which impacts negatively in the delivery of health services. FALDA hereby proposes a distinct approach in the funding of municipal health services. The approach should include the review of the revenue adjustment sector on municipal health services equitable share allocation and also promote improved budgeting for municipal health services by municipalities. FALDA's position is that actual own revenue potentially falls far short of what was assumed in the white paper. It is clear that the local government simply cannot fund 90% of its operating expenditure from own revenue sources given the reality currently. A critical area that is being neglected in response is maintenance. And there will be a substantial national price to pay for this down the line. Empirical evidence shows an approximate 50 billion shortfall in this financial year. So, Chair, not taking care of our financial infrastructure assets has dire consequences on these assets, which are expected to generate revenue for local government. The white paper assumptions about revenue collection from the on-setting of bulk services have proven to be incorrect. The white paper assumes that just 37% of all local government operating expenditure will be financed through the sale of electricity. The white paper assumptions about the ability of local government to access alternative funding options, including the municipal debt market and alternative service delivery options, have not materialized due to, in part, to over-zealous regulations. There is currently money lost each year due to poor and or mismanagement of funds, but this amount is only a fraction of the funding shortfall. Nonetheless, more concerted efforts should be put in place to reduce this. And the rising reporting compliance burden on local government has significantly increased operating costs in municipalities and to local budgets. Chair, regarding the Section 42 of the MFMA, the tariffs from water boards and ESCOM have a direct effect on the sustainability of the local government fiscal framework. The average of all the tariffs proposed by all nine water boards is 9.3%. ESCOM has applied for 15% tariff increases from NERSA, of which only 13.8% was approved as we had yesterday. Through the primary objective of tariffs from utilities, the primary objective of tariffs for utilities is institutional sustainability and generation of revenues to fund the operational and capital objectives. FALDA's position is that over the past 10 years, the unaffordable tariffs imposed on municipalities have led to untechnical losses and have a direct effect on profit margins of municipalities. This challenges the white paper, a national treasury notion that local government can generate its own revenue from trading functions and assignments. The current structure of the conditional funds is extremely counterproductive in our view, Chair. It is costly, particularly for smaller municipalities, unpredictable funding and the withdrawal of funds to punish municipalities is another issue. it falls to it fails to address the actual needs in municipalities, forcing them to prioritize programs that do not reflect local priorities. The infrastructure dynamics have changed, market use since 1998. Poor maintenance is creating a huge contingent liability in local government. It also undermines the revenue model through growing distribution losses and disincentivizing accounts payments. The white paper represented an innovative democratic experiment, and there was no precedent for what was being planned in respect of local government. It would truly be astonishing if all of these assumptions proved to be true. Chair. And as further, we recommend the following to ease fiscal pressure on local government. And our recommendations are short-term and long-term. Starting with the short-term, while it is clear that local government requires considerable additional funding, it is also clear that it is unlikely that the entire amount can be found within the current fiscal framework at short notice. As a matter of urgency, however, municipalities need to have an additional allocation for maintenance. It could be achieved by restructuring and increasing MID to allow it to be used for maintenance as well as allowing it to be used in any area of the municipality. So we are seeing the conditions of the MID, if they can be relaxed to cater for the maintenance. The outstanding accounts of other organs of state must be settled in full within 90 days. And in long-term, the policy changes are required to address the underlying structural problems that have created the current situation. A working group to critically review the current architecture and funding model for local governments based on the current fiscal reality of local governments, with the aim of drafting a new white paper for local governments, is recommended. The entire conditional grant system should be overhauled to make it more flexible, cost-effective, and efficient. The proposed restructuring of ESCOM must take into account the impact of the current distribution model on municipal financial viability. The powers and functions of municipalities need to be finalized as a matter of agency. This is the only accurate foundation of which, on which the current local government model can be evaluated. And a detailed investigation on the costs, benefits, and efficacy of existing municipal regulation reporting and compliance framework needs to be completed and regulatory changes made in this regard. Distribution losses and poor maintenance need to be correctly viewed as a national priority. And lastly, Chair, we recommend that the possibility of governance incentive components with regard to the equitable share formula be considered. The formula may consider amending, the consideration could be given to amending the formula such that municipalities that are governed well, both politically and administratively, be given a bigger part of the local government equitable share. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Salga, for your presentation. Stephen, you take note of what happened here in this presentation. We'll come back to this one, specifically referring to the role of budget forum that meets regularly. I've got a question there. I consulted Co-Chair Porter that we take all the presentations and then engage Western Cape Forum for Intellectual Disability. Where are you? Can you?
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Chair, and committee members and colleagues. Okay. I'm here from the Western Cape Forum for Intellectual Disability.
It says blue document, is it? That's it. Thank you.
I'll refer to us as the forum during my presentation. I represent about 200 members consisting of individuals, principals of special schools, and in special care centers. My focus will be on special care centers. These are NGOs in the community who have responded to a need caused by the fact that the Department of Basic Education refuses admission to children with severe to profound intellectual disabilities. My presentation takes three parts. One is some background to our advocacy, and then the court order which we obtained in 2010, the conditional grant, which is, this is the DBE conditional grant for the education of learners with severe to profound intellectual disabilities. The conditional grant, therefore, which the Minister of Education has said is a response to the court order, and then the management of the grant up to this period. So our organization provides the forum, providing network to these centers. We provide, develop and provide resources for them, provide training for them, and then do advocacy on their behalf, which is my role. A little bit about the children we represent. Firstly, they are excluded from schools at the moment, despite the constitutional requirements and the South African Schools Act requirements that children between the ages of 5 to 17 be provided with an education and reciprocal responsibility by parents. These children, generally in the severe intellectual disability group, have IQs between 20 and 34 and multiple other disabilities. Those who have profound intellectual disability generally have an IQ below 20, with multiple disabilities and with very little ability to take care of themselves. Our forum's advocacy started in 1997 when we recognized that the Constitution demands that all children be provided with basic education. After lobbying governments, marching on governments with children in buggies, we eventually took the Western Cape government as the second respondent and national government as the first respondent to court. The court ruled in our favour and provided national and provincial government with an order. Very broadly, I'm not going to go into each part of the order in detail, but very broadly, the court order demands that all children, and unfortunately, this court order is immediately applicable to the Western Cape only, but of course, it sets a precedent for children nationally. So the court ordered national and provincial government to provide affordable access to basic education for children at the special care centres, specifically funding for infrastructure and adequate staff provisioning, which amounts to staff remuneration, for them to provide transport, staff training and accreditation, and the training of staff to provide education for them. Now, our organization in the past 8 years was faced with being sent from pillar to post. from one government to another department be with the finger being pointed at to others as being accountable for having the mandate for various aspects of the grant. So what we've done is looked at jurisprudence in the past few years, which clarifies and determines the components of education. In each case, adequate facilities or infrastructure, payment of staff, learner transport, the court has ruled that courts have ruled in the past few years that GBE has the mandate for this, that these aspects are components of education. And we recognize that other departments have a supporting role to play in accordance with their mandate. So we're quite clear on the fact that this is GBE's responsibility. In the Western Cape, what has happened is that the Department of Social Development and the Department of Health have provided funds directly to centres as required by the court order. The funding is inadequate. You will note at the bottom of the slide that WCED provides no direct funding to centres. So that the case continues to be one of health and care and not one of education, which is what the court ruling was about. Currently, and we were very, very pleased to hear that GBE had been awarded a conditional grant for the education of learners in special care centres. Currently, WCED, and we represent centres in the Western Cape, this is where we are based, currently WCED uses only 11 million rand, which comes directly from the grant. I'll go into the grant a little bit later. So what I'd like to acknowledge is that there has been a response, but an inadequate response to the needs of learners in the special care centres. Currently, the learners in the sector have inadequate access to education. The majority are excluded from the state school system. The schools will just not accept them. Next slide, please. Then, there's no funding for infrastructure and inadequate staff salary contributions. These are NGOs. They rely on funding from government and from other donors. Currently, we are now in a position where the Department of Labour has visited a centre, quite correctly, to say, why are you not paying your workers, your caregivers, minimum wage? What seems to escape them is the fact that these are centres doing work on behalf of government in possession of a court order which says provide funds for these items. In terms of transport, there's a transport contribution which is inadequate, and the Western Cape government plans a pilot of 4 buses, 2 centres this year, that's 1 bus each to 4 centres, 2 more next year and 2 the following year, which is being funded by the Department of Social Development. There is no accredited staff training available, and I'll get back to that. The centres have not benefited from the training of special school teachers as is required by DORA B2 2018. The Minister of Education, to contextualise where the grant fits into the court order, In response to a written question, the minister responded that the conditional grant for the educational services fit is in response to the court order, and she gave the court order, which is the one I'm referring to. Now, she outlined how the fund would be spent, how the grant would be spent. Bear in mind what the court order required, bear in mind DBE's mandate. 13% for training teachers and outreach teams, 11% for LTSM, 56% for the compensation of outreach teams, and 20% for administration. So if you look at a comparison between the judgment and the DBE conditional grant, you will see the items excluded, the funds for adequate facilities, adequate staff, the provision of appropriate transport, accreditation, training and remuneration. So proper remuneration is excluded from the conditional grant. And then the training of persons to provide education. Order 28B2 2018 says that the special school teachers have to be trained and provide outreach to the centres. So what is that to do? Since DORA Bill B5-2019 uses the same framework as last year's one. I'd like us to look at how DBE has performed in the past year. And raise questions about how the grant is being managed, whether it is being used for the purpose it should be used, namely in response to the court order and the provision according to DBE's mandate, DBE's reporting on spending of the grant to the Portfolio Committee on Basic Education, and whether that is adequate. And I think I'd like to add that we are currently engaging with the Portfolio Committee, with DBE itself. So I'm not doing this in a vacuum. On Wednesday, we took the Portfolio Committee on Basic Education to see of the centres, two in Khayelitsha and one in Claremont, so that they had more information to allow them to perform their oversight function. So if we look at Audible B2 2018, and we look at human resources, which is in 2018's bill, most of the grant you would have seen is spent on the payment of staff, the outreach team. DBE reported that funds were withheld from Eastern Cape, Free State, and Popo, Northern Cape due to underspending. That was in the fourth quarterly report 2017-18. So we question whether those teams were even appointed. Our other concern is that this money, which is required by children in centres, is not being spent. Also, as I heard in presentations today, we run the risk of that grant being downgraded because it is not being used. In terms of the database for learners at special care centres, we believe, and DORA requires this, we believe that transitional drafts unless you have a framework to manage your statistics. And that these children should be loaded onto EMIS. I know that in the Western Cape we've been putting a lot of pressure on the MEC and HOD, that they have now started loading learners onto SA SANS. We would like to see these learners being included on DBE databases and provincial databases with the requisite identification number for DBE and the province, and that they then have access to the resources that children in schools already have. I'm not going to speak about DBE's conflation of severe, moderate and severe intellectual disability. That is something which we have taken up with them and they are considering. Then in terms of training, DORA 2018B requires that DBE develop an endorsed training program for caregivers at centres. No such program exists. The training which takes place occurs on site, it's ad hoc, and it provides no clear sense of the qualification that caregivers in these centres can obtain. Because part of DORA also talks about a career pathway that has to be created. And I'll speak about that more later. In terms of the outreach services, now these outreach services get 56% of the grants. What does that translate into for children at centres? In the Western Cape, it amounts to one visit a term over 3 days, which amounts to 6 to 10 hours. So if you look at the conditional grant and the amount that is allocated to it, all that learners are getting is 6 to 10 hours of service. And we have to question whether that is a good way to use money. In terms of the LTSM toolkit, and I'd like to raise a question here about GPE's reporting on money allocated and money spent. A province can report that money has been spent on toolkits, as is the case in the Western Cape. This money was spent early last year. About 4 or 5 of our centres received those toolkits for the first time this week on Tuesday. And we know they received those toolkits because we were taking the portfolio committee to those centres the next day. And so that raises concerns for us. And then in terms of the assessment of learners, learners are being assessed in groups only and not individually, although that is part of the DORA requirement. And in some cases, outreach teams are using existing centre assessments of learners, copying them instead of assessing the learners and doing their own reports. So, our view, the current conditions for grant structure is an inadequate measure to achieve learners' access to education in terms of the requirements of support order. So in terms of how the portfolio committee and other citizens are allowed to monitor the performance of the Department of Basic Education. The requirements of DORA B2 are consolidated into two performance indicators, DBE's Annual Performance Plan 2018-19.
Mm-hmm.
These are the number of children with access to therapeutic and psychosocial support services, and the number of children with access to the learning program. We question those performance indicators. Access is not defined. We have no idea of the quality of such access for learners. And without those learners being on a DBE and provincial education database, we have no idea which learners have had which types of access or access to which type of therapeutic services, nor whether each learner's assessment and individual education program is loaded onto such a database. The DBE has done a number of other things in its response, and I've summarized the responses and the challenges. So I've spoken about the conditional grant, and I'd like to reiterate our concern about the underspending of the grant and the withholding of funds in some provinces. Then, the draft policy for the provision of quality education has been presented for public comment. It should have been gazetted, promulgated, according to DORA 2018-19 by 2018. It has not yet been promulgated. It lacks a funding model. It does not provide for the coordination of state departments because it relies on health, social development, transport, and municipalities. The draft learning program has been gazetted for public comment, but as long as the caregivers in these centers are not trained, and as long as we don't have teachers in these centers, or these children are not placed in school, the learning program could be money wasted. They've also, DBE's also produced the draft national guidelines for resourcing an inclusive education system. The resourcing for special care centres is liberal and inadequate. We have submitted comments in that regard. The CAPS curriculum for severe intellectual disability is not suitable for learners with severe intellectual disability and more suited to learners with moderate intellectual disability. And then I think probably the most significant announcement was the Minister's announcement in Budget 14 last year that learners with first severe to profound intellectual disability would be incrementally enrolled in schools. We don't see much movement in that direction. We have met with DG Mueli, who has made a number of commitments, including getting the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation involved, and we would encourage that. We would even encourage the involvement of the DPME in oversight of the implementation of the conditional grant. DBE held a roundtable last year in which it made very positive commitments about amending the legislation policies around personnel administrative measures, finding centres, looking at centres as state schools and private land. Our concern is, and we really welcome these moves, our concern is that 8 years after the court order, and we have to remember that a normal compulsory span of education is the age of 7 to 15, that's 8 years. In other words, in 8 years, a lifespan of the education of a child has been missed. So 8 years after the court order, Basic Education Department and WCEDF yet to provide adequate access to education for learners with severe to profound intellectual disabilities in the Western Cape, with implications nationally. So on Monday, I had the chairperson of a forum of 52 centres in another province come to phone me and say, our provincial education department has come to us and said they are implementing the court order. These are the outreach teams. But they are refusing to implement various parts of the court order. And so it's an alert that this is not limited to the Western Cape, and this is the right of all children in the country, and that more and more centres and forums are becoming frustrated and angry at the rights of the children in these centres being violated and of the workers being violated. These are NGOs. And anybody else here who works in the NGO space says it's seldom that you get paid market-related salaries in the NGO space.
Can you wrap up in 2 minutes?
2 minutes.
I've got the solution for you.
Brilliant. Thank you. So, we'd like to recommend, let's go there. We would like to recommend that there be a review and revision of the current structure of the conditional grant, because it does not serve the purpose it was intended. And that the committees ask DBE to provide a drastic turnaround strategy to ensure that the conditional grant is spent timely and appropriately. Also to ask DBE to provide comprehensive reports annually, and being to urgently investigate the possibility of an appropriate pilot to implement the court order. I'm suggesting the Western Cape, because this is where I'm based, and this is where the court order is immediately applicable, as distasteful as it may be to some. And then I'm suggesting Gauteng as well, because I think when the reason I'm suggesting Gauteng is when one does a pilot, one looks for subjects that are capable, that are well managed and well led. And that we use the unspent grant on such a pilot to provide funding to centres for adequate staffing facilities, transport for learners and centres, the allocation or building of classrooms at local special schools or full service schools for learners at special care centres, or subsidies to special care centres, or that they subsidise special care centres at state schools on private properties or satellite campuses to special schools. I thank you.
Thank you, Vanessa. Vanessa, thank you for your presentation. All the members, this document, we must take with us when we go to our constituencies, because we must visit these facilities. And I'm repeating it every time that we've got hearings, joint meetings, etc. It's part of our constituency work as a deployee. Specific my party where I come from and represent, but all political parties. on a quarterly basis, or three times a year, to pick up the issues that were just raised. Thank you for this, and thank you for taking the portfolio committee to Kailicha, etc., and the other areas. Next week, on the 14th-15th of March, every province will have public hearings in the province on this bill. So there's another opportunity. And in the 6th Parliament, after the elections, come back. Because Parliament will then deal with the appropriation bill, the APPs of each department in both houses. So make use of that opportunity. Fine. Thank you. Equal education. Are you here? Equal education. Oh, there you are. Yes. I'm going to give you your 25 minutes as well. Other members, just get that document in front of you, to education. Thank you. Proceed. Just introduce yourself. One, two. I've got two documents on equal education. Yes, we should. Here you are. Okay. While the lady is preparing herself, Rural Health Advocacy Project, are they here? No. Budget Justice Coalition, are they here? No. Proceed.
All right. Good morning, Honourable Chair and members. My name is Babalu Kulichana, and I'm from Equal Education. I serve as a coordinatory officer and researcher. And today I will be taking you through our presentation on the submission of the 2019 Division of Revenue. Just to note that for the points that I will be referring to, much more information and detail is elaborated in the full submission. So to start us off, because we work in the basic education sector, this is what we'll be looking at in terms of the allocations in the Division of Revenue. The basic education sector makes up about 14.4% of the total consolidated budget for the financial year. While the sector allocations have remained relatively steady and marginally keeping up with inflation, the national allocations to the Department of Basic Education have not exactly been keeping up with inflation and have in fact been decreasing in proportion over the past 4 years. The next slide is a look at these appropriations that we've been speaking about. We've taken the nominal figures that are in the estimates of national expenditure, converted them into real figures, and what we see is that annually there's been a negative growth in the actual allocations to the DBE. This is just a graph which just shows or re-represents the real information, and you can actually see the step down in the allocations of each year and the dip that it's taken. Now, when we see that the budget or the allocations that are being given to these departments is decreasing in real terms, it begs to question what kind of services are they delivering? And the first aspect that I'm going to be looking at is school infrastructure. Now, this area continues to be a challenge for the basic education sector, but more particularly for the thousands of learners and teachers who have to be in those environments. EE began campaigning for the Norms and Standards Law in 2011, and then secured a victory in 2013 when the basic education minister promulgated this regulation. The National Education Infrastructure Management System, also called the NEIS report, shows us a snapshot of what infrastructure statistics look like in the country. And what we've seen since the promulgation of these norms and standards has been a positive correlation in the improvement in school infrastructure delivery. This table over here just shows that you can see that there's been a significant decrease in the number of schools with no water, electricity, sanitation, and crystal clean from 2011. This is the most recent national education infrastructure management system report, and that one was not released last year. However, while the improvements are noted, it has unfortunately not been at the pace that it should be. Now, when the Norms and Standards were promulgated, they had set deadlines in them, which are important for the realization of this law, but also for the delivery of school infrastructure. The first being on November 2016, and basically by that date, no school without while we can argue that year on year the infrastructure grant is getting more money, but you can see that the size of the money doesn't match up to the rate of inflation, and so it compromises what can be done in terms of infrastructure delivery. Similarly, the same thing can be noted with the school infrastructure backlog grant, and that was spoken about earlier in the presentation today. Again, you can see 2018 and 2019 financial years with negative growth. And essentially, the aspect of money is only one thing, because where money is allocated, what we're seeing is that these conditional grants or the person responsible for the EDC is failing to meet its targets. A CD, which is funded by the SIBG over here, I've taken out the last 3 years, and you can see that in 2016 they had a target to build 136 schools and only managed to build 16 schools. That performance has not improved over the years, because in 2017 they only managed to build 12, and in the first 6 months of last year were only able to build 9. The same pattern is seen with sanitation, with water and electricity, and sanitation is a particular issue because we've seen in the media reports that learners are paying with their, you know, with their lives, given these unsafe structures that exist. And so it raises serious questions, because when money is allocated, the department is unable to use it, but also we as an advocacy group are still advocating for more money to be allocated. So there definitely needs to be an investigation into why does this department struggle to meet its annual target. And last year in a portfolio committee meeting, the DG really responded to say that they were, I think, over-optimistic in their allocations, and what they're going to do is revise them down in the next MTSF. Now that is a serious issue, because it's not speaking directly to the issues that are hampering delivery on the ground, but rather saying that we've been unable to meet these targets, they're too high, so we're just going to take them down and start to essentially report that we are, you know, meeting infrastructure delivery at 100%, when actually they are behind in terms of the first deadline, and are essentially set to miss their next 2020 deadline, which is the next aspect of the Monson standard. This is just a graph which just shows where money has been appropriated and allocated, there has not been spending. So, similar pattern throughout the infrastructure graph. The next area is in early learning. In the 2019 SONA, President Ramaphosa indicated strong commitments to prioritize early years. These included the announcement of the introduction of a 2-year compulsory early childhood development service, a shift of the ECD service from DSE to DPP, and lastly the expansion of the early grade reading status. However, when the budget speech was then delivered a week later, none of these commitments were reflected in the budget. In terms of ECD, we have previously stated that part of why there are poor results in metrics or poor outcomes in metrics is because there's an underinvestment in the early years of foundation phase schooling. So by the time the learner gets to metrics, there's missed quite a bit of substantial knowledge and foundation laying that should have been there. But because there's this overemphasis that we need to get metric results, you're never going to be able to solve an issue if you're meeting it at the end and not at the root cause. We were hopeful when the president not only spoke to the importance of investing in early learning, but that also saw that this facilities could be in better access for children, and could also mean that the actual centers could have more funding to equip them with the necessary tools. However, we know that the ECD grant was introduced in 2017 and has underperformed previously, and so there's no clarity really on how the 2 years is going to be introduced when the fund itself isn't performing where it should be, and the allocation is projected to be setting over the next 3 years. The next aspect of early learning is the early grade reading study or ETRS. We have made repeated calls about expanding yet again the study. The Progressing International Reading Literacy Study, which is a study that South Africa participates, gets ranked on an international standard. The last report came out in 2016, and it showed that grade 4 learners, or about 80% of grade 4 learners in this country, cannot read for meaning. So yes, they can what the sectors mean, they cannot go beyond that point. So now, when we come back and we see that there's a commitment to say that these EGR services are going to be expanded, but then you look at the budget and there's no correlation with that, is really concerning, especially because the implementation of other EGR services has been slower than planned. So the real question is, what do we do with this cohort of grade 4 learners who can't read for meaning, but who are supposed to continue and progress into their later years of their schooling career? The next thing that I'll be speaking on is then the revision of the provincial equitable share formula, which is something that the committee should be familiar with. EE has previously presented and made submissions on this very topic, particularly in relation to the education component of the equitable share. And we've raised concerns that the formula doesn't cater for the high cost of providing quality education in rural provinces, particularly because of their geographic location and historic underfunding. Now, this is an aspect that CPE themselves have said, for instance, when providing schools with infrastructure, they struggle in Eastern Cape and Limpopo because the terrain is completely different, and it does take a little bit more planning and more funds to make this possible. However, this aspect that makes the provision of education facilities and services in rural areas is not considered in the formula. We have welcomed the National Treasury's commitment to reviewing the formula, but still await for the time frame for the review process to be made public. We note that the 2019 Division of Labour Union Bill speaks to the continued work of this review process, noting the inclusion of a new data collection methodology for the education component, and that's that mirrored system which captures live statistics of learners in the country. However, while this review process takes place, there has been no mention of the structure of the process. So what are the plans, where is it going, how long is it going to continue for, and when can civil society organizations like us interact with the process? The information provided in the explanatory memorandum has been extremely vague, and so it makes it impossible for us to really, you know, get a feeling of what the public can expect and when we can interact with the process. The last point is then related to the equitable share, because we have been calling for a conditional grant for learner transport. And I mean, yes, we have heard that providing a conditional grant doesn't necessarily solve the provision of a particular aspect. And in fact, from the historic understanding of SIBG, we should be trying to run away from conditional grants. But what we have seen is that current provision of learner transport is funded through the provincial equitable share allocations. However, provincial education departments have cited inadequate funding as one of the main reasons for not providing qualified learners with transport. So this is learners who qualify to get transport, but because there isn't enough money, that money is often allocated elsewhere, or there's a service that is being provided. So essentially, all these basic services that provincial education departments are responsible for are being pitted against each other, depending on what the priority is. And the real reason that we come to this conclusion is because EE has been mobilizing and capturing us from the provinces that we're in, and we have testimonies and affidavits from learners and the kinds of incidences that befall them as they take these 10 kilometers, you know, to school and back. Last year, the Standing Committee on Appropriations invited the Human Sciences Research Council to present on the state of the transport provision, and in their presentation they highlighted that KZN is the province with the highest demand of learners in need of transport. But for nearly 3 years, National Treasury and the DPMB have been looking into developing a conditional grant, yet no information is available on the of the study. The DPMB then released a report of the study into the provision of learner transport and last year, which the 2019 DORA states that had several data gaps. Now, when this report came out, EE was asked to make comments, and we wrote to the Department of Transport and DPMB last year, raising serious concerns that we Secondly, was the depth and accuracy of the analysis. So the first aspect there was that there's no substantiating evidence for why the report declares the analysis of the National Learning Transport Policy to be a relatively well deserved. We have argued in the past that the 3-kilometer radius is too small because the learners who live even further from their schools, and so if the basis is 3 kilometers, that excludes a whole number of learners who qualify and deserve to be provided with learner transport. The next was that it failed to note that KZN learner transport is still currently under review, so it makes a blanket statement that all the provincial learner transport policies have actually been completed and are in effect, but we know for sure that KZN is currently being reviewed and the policy is being reviewed. It does mean that from time to time the implementation of that policy will be affected by what comes out of that review. The next thing is that the report concludes that data provided by Collins is correct and neglects to highlight that the KZN numbers cited in the report are actually incorrect. In a responding affidavit to Equal Education, the KZN Department of Education revised its estimates from 90,000 to 370,000 learners in the province that are in need of transport. That officially then calls into question all of the other figures that are quoted in the report, because if they can make such a, you know, a miscalculation or such an incorrect number, that means that an investigation could be, you know, done into what the other numbers for the other provinces are and whether those are correct or incorrect. Now, the issue with citing incorrect numbers is that these same incorrect figures are then used to inform the costing that is done in the report, which results in a misleading conclusion that the learner transport program has actually been largely successful. Meanwhile, they've only been providing learner transport services to about 80% of the total number of learners who are in need of transport. So after detailing all of this, we then came to a couple of recommendations, which are that we urge the committee to firstly consider increasing the education sectoral budget, but also the national DBE allocation to at a minimum keep up with inflation, because a rising cost of services and goods in general means a rising cost of provision of education. We're asking the committee to reverse the 7 billion cuts to the school infrastructure grants over the NTF, and these were affected in the 2018 budget. And you can see in the projected numbers over the next couple of years that we're still seeing the effects of those reductions. We ask that the committee ensure that National Treasury funds the expansion of CGR services, as well as finalize investigation into the feasibility of the Skoda Transport Grant. And finally, to ensure that the equitable share formula process is made publicly available and particularly the time frame so we know when it is going to be completed.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Also, honourable members, homework for us. When Vanessa presented, when this good lady presented, that's her homework. I will hand over to Co-Chair Porza to do the deliberations part, just to Treasury. A couple of matters were raised here, also by SALGA, and in a sense by FFC, and I will recycle this. If it's possible, today's Friday. On Tuesday, the Standing Committee will consider their report to be tabled on Wednesday in the National Assembly. If it's possible by Monday to get a response from the Treasury side to matters that was raised here. To Vanessa and our good lady, I just requested my PA to bring you each the document. It's a book that thick, the estimates of expenditure. That's your homework I'm giving you, that you can go and read that. And you're welcome with the other meetings when we deal with the appropriation bill. That's when every department presents the budget, APP plus the budget. How does it fit together? Right. Honourable members, there were other submissions as well from the from King Bergazulu, from Freya. We acknowledge these presentations, it's been tabled here, from Mr. or Mrs. Alcora Matalala, I don't know from where, there's just a post box. Jane Fuzi, I don't know where that is. The budgeting in a time of austerity and state capture from the Budget Justice Coalition, here it is. Western Cape Forum for Intellectual Disability, there's another paper that was presented off table, and the Rural Health Advocacy Project. So those papers that was sent to us, we acknowledge, it's tabled here and will be captured in our report. Honourable members, I will now hand over to Honourable Porter. Yeah, we're done there.
Thank you very much, honourable members and ladies and gentlemen. I would like to start by thanking all the presenters for their informative and insightful presentation. Thank you very much. To the honourable members, you have now received briefings from all these stakeholders on the 2019 Division of Revenue Bill as part of our public consultation exercise, which is required by the Money Bills Act number 9 of 2009. Now, for easy facilitation, or let me start by saying, I would like members to reflect on all these presentations, and for easy facilitation, members can ask questions from any of these presentations, as the stakeholders will then be focusing on their focus area and take down those questions for later responses to those questions. I will now open the floor for questions. Over to you, honourable members.
Free State.
Honourable member.
Member Free State.
Honourable member. Because maybe I might not know all your names, I'll then call you by numbers. Number
yeah.
one,
yeah.
honourable member Shadowton. Number two. This is the only two heads. Number
yes,
three,
yes.
Honourable Member Smukwanyane. Number four, Honourable Member Manana. For now, let's allow number five, Honourable Member Shopestole. So we will now take the five, and then the members will be allowed another round, time allowing. Over to you, Honourable Member Shopestole.
Thank you, Chair. It's nice to be number one, seems I've
don't wake up, we don't want to just focus on your question, please.
Most of my questions are for the FFC, Chair. On slide 16, the FFC argues that readjustment should not tamper with approved service delivery plans. Does the FFC believe that this would be feasible to do? In other words, would it be feasible to reprioritize the budget between project and grants without affecting delivery plans? On slide 23, the FFC argues that the proposed one-year testing window period for the upgrading of urban informal settlements that it might not be enough time to make conclusions on its performance and efficacy. If 1 year isn't enough, how much time would be ideal? Then I noticed on slide 7, it's stated that measures are insufficient to close the widening gap between revenue and expenditure. Could the FFC enlighten us as to some possible measures they would suggest introducing by which we could close the gap between revenue and expenditure, which I think we all think we would all agree it's something necessary to do. And on slide 25, the FFC seems to praise or laud or mention that there is a 7.4% growth in social protection expenditure. But then, however, what do you make of the fact that the child grant hasn't been increased to either meet or to exceed the poverty line? It doesn't even meet it at this juncture. The slide mentions the need to protect the most vulnerable in our society, which are probably children, and would you deem it feasible to bring the child grant in line with the poverty line? And then I'm almost done, Chair, but to Salva, just on slide 5, it mentions that revenue collection rates have decreased across municipalities. Do you have any suggestions that could be implemented so as to stop revenue collection rates decreasing? On slide 6, you've mentioned that other parts of government must pay their accounts to local government on time. Do you have any proposals by which that could be enforced? I think for years now, we talk to councillors, we talk to people across government departments, that's always a regular complaint, but we always seem to say that it must be done. But perhaps we need to come up with harsh enforcement mechanisms.
And thank you, that was your last question.
Okay. Thank you very much. I do have questions for every question, but I'll leave them for the problem question we need to be specific, so I don't want to go in detail. I want to go straight to that. I'm actually confused about it, but it's fine. Let me start with this picture. I'm confused about many things that were mentioned by Kankai. Not myself, I'm confused as a person. No, I'm not here. Chair, maybe Salva must explain deeper as to what is meant by the statement that says address confusion over the certain powers and functions between local government and other parts of government. Maybe I need to elaborate the question, Chair. I believe that all of us, we know the roles and functions. And even in my questions of yesterday, I tried to touch on the question. In terms of Section 152 of the Constitution, the roles and responsibilities of local governments are there. Then we have the Migration Act that will also deal with the functions and powers of the municipality. Now, then you've got the IGR document also that will deal with all those issues. Maybe I'm the one I'm making this confused. So they explain exactly what do they mean about this initiative of clarifying of roles and functions of the local government and other spheres of government. I'm going to touch up and down. Sometimes I want to make reference to the pages, but I've got another specific page, I believe it's on page 36. Let me start on page 12. I think it's about on the white paper or conditional grants. You are saying the conditional grants are becoming costly, particularly for smaller municipalities. And that statement is verified to you. In a sense of which your conditional grants are there to serve a specific particular reason. Now, how do conditional grants become costly to the smaller municipalities? I want to see conditional grants linking it with the equitable share. Because you also had your issues around the equitable share. The equitable share specifically on the smaller municipalities. Fraksha is the one that deals with your indigenous, that will deal with your free services. I want to intertwine the two. And that conditional grant on this smaller municipalities, it will also be used for administrative purposes and also many other issues in the frame of that. Now, you are saying conditional grants are being costly. You are even further saying the NIC must be allowed to be utilized for any other purpose, also including maintenance. Now, I am lost. Because you can't say municipal infrastructure of grants. It must be used for any other things. Where I'm sitting, my conclusion will be saying to me, I might be wrong, you're correct. You will be then saying to us that you need to agree to say it must also be challenged for that. Unless you're any other people to do something else, not what I'm actually thinking of where I'm sitting. because it is for development. I agree that the smaller municipalities won't be in a position to have the muscle as your cities and everything, but they can see them. And I'm going to give an example of what I'm finishing. Please, Alan, I want to go to my other questions. I want you to just to get on this one. On the smaller municipalities, I need you to go back and check what I'm saying to you. Go back, because the provinces, I believe that you are from the national level, but you've got provinces. Go back and check, because I still ask the issue of, I need to start there, the issue of municipalities are unable, that's where I'm getting to, what I'm going to give you as an example, to say, municipalities are unable to collect services. That thing is in the hand of them, and I'm going to substitute. Check. Let's go back and check what used to happen before 2011 to today in local municipalities. Many municipalities were able to collect taxes. They had funded budgets. And I'm going to tell you what again caused that. And you must go back and take a research and look into that. We need to look each other, not to defend. I know that for the specifics to look at that issue. But in doing so, also assist municipalities to be sustainable. But if we are going to want us to rely on handouts, then we are not a sphere of local government, upper government. We are dependent on national improvement, and that is not what we are there for as a local government. That's my argument. Go back and check some of the most smaller ministers. They were able to have their own funding, to be able to maintain their own projects, to be able even also to construct their own projects. But the only challenge, Honorable Council, is that municipalities have been turned into the employment agencies. That's where the dilemma is. You are there today, you are a political leader of a particular municipality. I'm just speaking of a good thing that is what you do. When you leave, you've got your own political staff. Now, that political staff has been absorbed in the institution, and already there is always creating problems. So I think we need to refactor and agree on terms and conditions that need to be. Because the other thing, we are paying our employees a limited amount of money. I'll give a practical example for the three states, the usual district. That's what I'm saying. From one point of perspective. There was this law that I was taking, I don't know where, but it was not part of the law. It said, individual resources, irrespective of the size of the municipality, the municipal managers will pay around this particular budget. Those municipalities are unable to collect revenue, but you are the bracket in terms of payment of your people is over. So I think some of them need to start to look into this, because honestly, it is not going to serve the purpose of assisting your member ministers to be sustainable and efficient. So I think those are the things. Maybe again here on the issues of functions and responsibility, you also touched on the environmental issues. I here yesterday to say you need to really look into the existence of the municipalities, because majority of I'm letting share my own thing. They are relying solely on grants for their survival. And they've got responsibility to assist, to coordinate and support local municipalities. But some of the local municipalities want more assistance. So we still urge them to help them, and they still, because the environment was devolved to the municipalities, but they are unable to keep that particular responsibility check. So let me call that check. It will want me to go further and further. I still believe that the white paper is still relevant, Chair. It's still relevant, but we need to go back and relook as to how to do that on. So thank you.
Thank you very much for the question. Next, I think it's Honourable Member Snukwanyani.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, and thank you to all the presenters. I have one question for SSP. The same side is still in my colleagues are speaking to us. In terms of the commissioner grants, where you say the commission stands, is that funding should be reprioritized away from underperforming grants, as reasons underperforming grants are a problem. But now, taking the grant away from them, what are the implications? In terms of service delivery, because sometimes one thinks that perhaps there's a problem of capacity or whatever the problem is, but if you take it away, if you can just speak to that, because we go on to say readjustment should not hamper with approved delivery plans. And that should be called from for SSP.
And then, Sarga, in your slide number 6, Sarga's use on the Senior Prevenue Bill, the bottom line, and you speak of the gap that can be filled by the combination of various things. I will just pick on a few. I will pick on, I think, 3. You say national incentives to enforce commercial customers to settle their debt. Perhaps if you can just say something about it, how you think you would want to do that, because currently that is one of the biggest challenges that municipalities are having. So what incentives are you looking at? And the reduction of the reporting compliance burden. I'm not too clear about what actually that burden is. And then removing Eskom from the municipal electricity distribution. Do you think you will cope with the challenges that Eskom is also having at the moment with the non-payment? We're not talking about the corruption and whatever, but just non-payment, particularly about the very commercial customer also, because it's one of the biggest problems that they have, and even individual customers don't pay electricity, get stolen. I understand it gets stolen even about by the workers there. And then, of course, I can agree with you more about the other spheres of government. It's always been a problem for many of us that they do not pay their accounts and they expect the municipality to function. This is the case. And then I think the next one that I was just on the Western Cape Forum. I saw that it's a number of organizations that are involved in this particular center. I would like to just find out what the status really of are these NGOs, how many are they, just an estimate of how many and their geographical spread in the Western Cape. But later on when you spoke of recommendations, you also mentioned something. I know you said something, but I didn't quite understand your explanation. And you mentioned also that accreditation, in terms of the court order, you mentioned a number of things. I won't go into them, but issues of teachers not being accredited. So who are these caregivers? What skills do they have currently now that the department is there? Has not been able to assist you. And in addition to that, you said teachers from special schools are not assisted. Are they supposed to come and do sessions or something like that? But maybe one question I would want to find, is the Department of Social Development involved in this process? Because I know that people with disabilities of all ages in social development as for the people to say.
All right, and then, okay, thank you very much. Next is Honourable Member Schottenstoller. Manana? All right. Thank you very much for correcting me. Honourable Member Manana?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I would like to start by welcoming the everyone of the presented here. My first question is directed to the SARGA. When you were here last time, I raised the issue of the revenue collection, where we are seeing this declining. And I indicated that some of the municipalities, they are not issuing their bills to their customers. Chairperson, when we were passing this, you said we are agreeing with the Honorable Member for Policy. We were not. You were trying to teach me how to go through to the website of Emala Kane, because I've been trying. people they are saying they don't want to pay. I'm one of those people who are not paying as of now because I'm not getting the bill. Myself. And they say we must use this budget. I've been trying to figure it out. At the end of the day, I was asking this lady, because it's younger than me, maybe we can go to the website of the magazine so that I can get the information. She also paid. Chapter 2, we're not saying, we're teaching you something. That is why I'm saying, if the municipality are not serious about collecting its own revenue, indeed, the municipality is going to go down. Communities are not giving their bills. They are not. They are referred to these gadgets. You must go and do it there. Maybe I will get the explanation. How far did you go? Because I read it. In your presentation, please, where we are talking about the local government finances that are in distress, you mentioned that 40 municipalities have negative cash balances at the end. Which are these municipalities that I presume another thing is one of them? The issue on page 6, where we are raising the third view, have you discussed this matter at the budget forum with all your views? That is why some of us who are so amazed that the issue of confusion needs to be addressed. Maybe if you can tell us what is this confusion all about. FFC on site 6, where we are talking about the public investment growth contribution flow from 0.3 at the beginning of the same year to 0.1. Could the FFC enlighten the committee about the actual area of public sector investment that has slowed down? On slide 5, what is the commission assessment of the announcement financial assistance to ESCO? Is it really budget neutral and will be enough to plug the hole the hole in the balance sheet of the power utility?
Thank you very much. Yes. Thank you very much, and thank you for the question. Honourable Member Shoppe Sole.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you also for the program. My question goes to the FFC. I just want to know how you can assist us as since your duty is to assist us. How can we shape our oversight in a manner that will be effective? Because, you know, I sit here being very worried when I hear that local government accountability is deteriorating. And, you know, I'm the type of person who prefer to caused by the fact that maybe we have not been effective as overseers. I also remember, you know, the first Secretary of State of the United States, Hamilton, had this to say, that people will not account unless they are made to account. So the whole question of
come to prison. I'm one person who is not impressed when I hear members of parliament say, hey, there's corruption. Where were we? Because we get our salaries every month.
Yes.
15 now, next week, my phone will ring. So every time my phone rings, I ask myself, why am I paying? Because you see, it's very clear. The duty of the judiciary is very clear. Actually, it is the judiciary who should be pronouncing the word corruption because it's their aim. But when members of parliament stand up in parliament, they are corruption, whatever. I immediately think that, you know, this guy, his salary should be retained to the coffers of the people. It means we are not effective. Because the people who make the constitution were very clear in their mind why they have to have the arm, the legislative arm, done. Our task is to oversee government. The task of government is to make all these activities. And you know, in the process of when people will make mistakes, we are making no mistakes here because I'm still working. Or we have got a wrong method of doing oversight. My request to Sparta, no, not Sparta, my request to the SSC, can you advise us on the system, maybe the system is not right, what is it that we can do differently so that we don't have this level of deteriorating accountability in the Republic of South Africa? And I would like Congress Charles Shepherd to also try to answer this question. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair, Co-Chair.
Yeah. There will be induction periods when the elected or nominated new members come to the sixth parliament to constitute the sixth parliament and start working. And I will make a recommendation to the leadership. Maybe that the FFC form part of that progress. Looking at our role in fiscal oversight, how do you measure performance? What must you do to get better results? And the whole matter of accountability. And now my question to Salva, on slide 6, bullet point 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, sub-bullet 7, reduction of the reporting compliance burden. Why do you say it's a burden? While municipalities as a sphere of government have to account in terms of the MFMA, because that's law, and the constitution. And I repeat my proposal of yesterday, that the four committees, the two on appropriations in both houses, and we can include the two committees on cocktail in the two houses, on a quarterly basis, engage with municipalities on their performance and spending, and the departure point is chapter 6 in the budget review. That's a departure point. That does become honorable co-chair part of our legacy report. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would also like to ask a question from Saga.
Sorry, yes.
Oh, yes. I remember you. Please, come
here. I'm hiding in the corner.
So don't block the honorable member.
Sorry, we didn't see you.
Thank you for the recognition. I won't take much time at all. Just for FFC, see. As part of an answer to quite a bit that's been said, I would ask your view, because you've given us your view on all these new clauses, most of which you welcome, but there's no clause anywhere here that introduces any higher level of consequence or penalty for anybody who doesn't comply. Don't you think that would be a very good idea? The question was just asked here now, how can we go about changing things? How can we go about improving accountability? There's an old adage in the English language that says, when the cat's away, the mouse will play. And all it means is that when you're allowed to do something, you get away with it, you can keep on doing it. So once you bring in some means to say to people, if you do this, there's a consequence. You will face a penalty of some sort, whether it's a hefty fine, lose your job, go to jail, whatever it might be, that will change this whole culture. I'm convinced of it, and I would like your opinion on it, please. Slide 15. Again, you might say that the transition must be accompanied by greater oversight and deception to minimize carrying out. But you don't say who you recommend should carry out that oversight. We hear a lot about this. It's part of what Sarah was saying, what Honourable Tabea was also saying. We're talking about oversight. Even Honourable Thorpe Sartori also mentioned this oversight. It's our job as Parliament to oversee things, but we can't be at the coal front all the time watching what's going on. Then we would never be in Parliament, we couldn't fulfill our other functions. But there must be some mechanism in place that says who should be responsible for this oversight, and surely some responsibility, some kind of culpability must also attach to that. So if you don't do the correct oversight, you'll also be guilty of failing your duty.
Yeah.
Then, sorry, make a statement on slide 17. Despite its good performance, the human settlements development grant has been reduced by 3 billion. National Treasury told us earlier this week that the reason why their grant has been reduced by 3.2 billion was because of the historical poor performance. You seem to be in disagreement with National Treasury over that. Perhaps you could just tell us why you think the human settlements development grant has performed well. And then for Selga, I just, in a sense, I wanted to defend a few things you said here. On slide 6, by the way, I thought the Selga presentation was excellent, well done to you. The reduction in reporting compliance burden. When I was still in local government, and Auditor General came along and informed us that we were going to have to introduce all sorts of new systems in order to comply with all the new things that we're bringing in, I made the point to them that that's all very well, but if you want us to comply with all these additional things, we're going to have to employ more staff to do it. That costs money, and we don't have the budget for it. They denied it. They said, oh, no, just people who've got them, just put it in and do it. Well, I beg to differ. It doesn't work like that. You have to have special personnel to go and do that compliance. And that is one of the reasons why it's a burden. Because a reporting burden, when it's normal and you just have your normal reporting to do, it's fine. But as time progresses, that burden becomes heavier and heavier because more and more compliance issues are raised. You have more and more boxes to tick. And you can't just do it in the normal course of things. You have to import special people to do it. So, personally, I understand what you're saying. Then you say, additional confusion over the respective powers and functions between local government and other parts of government. I'm sure some of my colleagues here may remember I made quite an issue at one stage about the situation involving the sanitation at schools, because I visited every school in my constituency and I couldn't find one school that didn't have a broken toilet. Not a single one. There's either water flowing everywhere or the toilets are full of rubbish, nothing's working. And when I tried to take someone to task, the Department of Basic Education said, well, it's actually our responsibility, but we can't do it because the local municipality isn't providing us with the assistance. And the municipality, they say, no, it's public works.
Yeah,
so it goes on, you get shunted from pillar to post. And I'm sure, in a sense, that's what you're referring to about this confusion, because for me, trying to do oversight and trying to find who, where the accountability lies, I'm also confused, because everybody passing the buck to somebody else. And it's not the only area where it happens. It happens to several areas in local government. So I get that. I do understand. I don't want to fix it, but I think we should have a much better delineation. You know, we have the IGR Act and all this kind of thing. It's all very well having the laws, but if you're not going to apply them and make sure they're implemented, then they're not worth having. And a lot of the time, that's the problem. And the reason why it is because, again, there's no consequences. Then just my colleague there made a comment about using wind for other purposes. Unfortunately, it happens. It's happening already. It's been happening for a long time. Municipalities are getting into trouble, start using their grants to pay operational expenses. We know it happens. It's not right. It shouldn't happen. But I can understand why you're now asking for permission to happen, because it's necessary, because you're short of money. And I understand as well that as the economy slips further and further, there's less and less economic activity. People are buying less and less electricity from municipalities. Your income goes down. It might not go down in numbers, but its usability goes down because of inflation and things like that. And there's got to be some way out of that for you. I have a few respect. I've argued in this parliament for 5 years now that the municipality should receive more than 9% of the national budget, because you are the coal face. And when municipalities cannot collect money from their residents for rates and taxes and consumption because the people no longer have the money to pay, what are you expected to do? You do whatever you can. Now, central government wants you to go and borrow more money. Now, I say that's wrong. You can't borrow more money because then you're getting yourself into the same trouble with national governments in. You're going to spend more money than you've got on just servicing your debt. So we have to find some other way around this. My opinion, the only way to fix it is to improve our economy and get everything running properly again. But I do get where you're coming from. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for your intervention. All right, coming from me, indeed we appreciate the submissions by the different stakeholders. But the question that I would like to ask from all the different stakeholders is that during the budget process, the minister would also invite the public,
yeah,
you know, to comment on the budget before it is tabled in the House. I'd like to know if you have tried to also make submissions at that stage before the budget is compiled and tabled to the House. Have you done that? Because then you will then come here and say, after we have tabled, we see this, you know, in your analysis of the budget, after we've made these recommendations, but we see this has not been considered, and then maybe you request the committee to look at it, because the Appropriations Committee can amend the budget. But we can't start at the tail end. Alright?
That's the people.
Yeah, alright. And then further, slide 6 makes a point about the excessive underfunding of local government, and further mentions a study conducted to confirm this. There's a research study, I'm sure. There's a research report that is on your table. I'd like to know if FADA has made this report available to National Treasury, because to me you're a key stakeholder. I'm sure at one point you should have at least had an appointment and had an engagement with National Treasury, and also I know that FADA participates at the budget conference. Have you made this report available to the minister?
Yeah.
All right. Does the study give specifics or a breakdown of the type of municipalities that are underfunded? E.g., are metro also underfunded? Or have you identified some metros that are underfunded as well? Okay. But we would also, as the two committees, would also like to have a copy of this chapter so that, you know, for our reference, so that we have a deeper insight on what exactly you have researched on and your findings and your recommendations. I think it would end here, just for reference.
Just for Vanessa, a quick one.
For Vanessa, quickly.
Vanessa, in your presentation you referred to and other provinces. Which provinces? Can you just clarify that for us? Because we in the NCP represent a province with a provincial mandate. Yes.
Okay. Again, for Australia, the issue of unfunded mandate has been raised many a times. Even the budget review acknowledges this. According to SALDA, what is the main contributing factor to this issue and what will it take to resolve it? Because what we are saying, because you also have got an oversight function over the municipalities, you must also come up with proposal. So in this case, what do you think it would take, you know, to correct this status quo? Again, on slide 12, SALDA argues that the current grant structure is characterized by unpredictability of funding. I think we would like SALDA to expand on what you actually mean by unpredictability of funding, because our understanding is that South Africa uses an MTEF planning and budgeting framework, and this makes the budget process more transparent and predictable. But also the fact that around August, October, the very budget gets reviewed so that if maybe there were gaps that you identified, you then, in terms of the review process, when you talk about your budget appropriation amendment, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, the adjustment, yes, I wanted the word adjustment. So that you can then correct if there was something that was left out, and then you plug into that and then you make a recommendation in the adjustment process. Another point is that, of course, in terms of the expenditure of the MEEC, municipalities are required to project their MEEC spending plans. Spending plans, which means the budget will then be linked to that, the MEEC will be linked to that budget. That is subjected, that is submitted. So this, to me, is for ensuring that resources are spent for the intended purposes. This one is flowing from the unpredictability that you have referred to in your presentation. All right, to FFC. Of course, the budget review puts emphasis on the fact that the 2019 Division of Revenue Bill is highly redistributive. Now, has FFC assessed the degree to which the proposals contained in the 2019 DORA are biased towards poor households and rural provinces? Again, on slide 14, FFC argues that conditional grant allocations to provinces and municipalities continue to bear the brunt from budget cuts and reprioritization spending over the next 3 years. But I know National Treasury has got a budget principle that says where money has not been spent, that money will be, you know, cut and reallocated to where it will be best used, because any budget is for service delivery. And where service delivery or the structure fails to use that budget for service delivery, unfortunately, it will be cut and reallocated to other programs. We need to accept that where budget has been cut, it means those structures have failed to use the budget for the purpose for which it was budgeted for. We need to also, you know, look at that one. And then make a proposal on how can
those structures or programs be strengthened and be made to use the budget that has been allocated, and they don't lose it. Because we're talking about it now after people have failed to use that budget for the purpose for which it was allocated. So it talks to weakness also in our implementation, in our program implementation. So weakness, how can that be strengthened? So as this committee, the two committees, were busy with the 2019 DORA, we would like the FSC to explain if there are specific conditional grants which the FSC is of the view that they should not have been subjected to budget cuts and reprioritization. I think those would be my questions. We will now hand over to both Estrada. I know I challenged all the other stakeholders in terms of submissions to the budget process by the minister, but now this is the second day by Parliament. So over to you, starting with FSC.
Thank you, Chairperson, and honourable members of the questions and comments again. Given there were specific responses asked on different slides, just for managing the outputs, if I can just quickly let my colleagues know from the office that on slide 6, a comment was raised by Public Investment Group. Cheng Wei is going to respond to that. Slide 7 on the issue of the REC, cutting conditional grants and the sufficient measures between providing gap between revenue and expenditure. We announced 82 responses, can be very quick responses because these people are specialized in these areas. On the slide 16 on the readjustments, areas can respond to that. On the whole question of the human settlement development grant, Dr. Mube is going to respond to that, Mube is going to respond to that. On the slide 20, the slide on speaks to the 20% question, I think the slide 26, I can't see the number properly, 23, Dr. Mube is going to respond to that. And then on slide 25, on the social ground matter, there is the honourable member. Eddie is going to respond to that again. Just to let you also know that the CEO of the FSC and the Secretary of the FSC is also present. And we also ask her and Commissioner to respond. But can I just pull two together the issue of honourable Scotland and the honourable member addressed the issue on oversight, but the consequence of oversight is actually one point that I would like to respond to. There is a classic example that an oversight, the case that I can immediately speak to is when the Northwest Intervention, Ad Hoc Committee of Intervention was established. Mr. De Beer, the chairperson of that committee, I don't know whether it's the same De Beer, but Mr. De Beer of that whole committee, approached the FSC to attend and be part of the inputs made and also give like inputs about how previous interventions are dealt with and what is the FSC's view on it. Including in that is what are the things that needs to be looked at within the intervention. Because Parliament has a particular responsibility, but there's other information that we have in the policy and financial and fiscal interactions with a range of inside government stakeholders and outside government that gives us a particular view of how the policy question is to be dealt with. What has been disappointing on a range of parliamentary engagements, and I'm saying the same point I made last year, and I think it's worth repeating at the end of this parliament, is that I think it's sometimes difficult for portfolio committees and select committees and sometimes standing committees to be able to know exactly what is the utility of the FSC. And some of them forget that the Finance and Fiscal Commission is a constitutional structure which needs to be called in on individual votes to the collective votes in terms of appropriations, and that we have the information that we could provide you without fear or favor on the performance of budgets, whether it's going to do with the agenda of economic performance, fiscal performance, service delivery performance, and what are the efficiencies that we have. But that has been a missing thing, and I've been pushing with the team to continuously make sure that Parliament actually gets to grasp that particular understanding. But clearly we need to find better ways to interact with that. So if you go out on a visit to resident education visit, or it's always worthwhile to approach the FFC for information about what has been the performance within a particular province on education, on health, on social development services, and so on and so forth. And during that exercise that we had with the ad hoc committee, one could easily get information and say to the chairperson, here's some information that might be find useful in terms of managing your interventions within that. So I think there's a need to understand that. And also what's also problematic is that some committees only call us when they struggle with an agenda people to present, and they say, no, no, you can't do this to us. You need to give us prior notice, like the two finance committees are doing. Give us prior notice so that we prepare. It's not an issue of malicious compliance for you to call us, just to make sure that you get the report from us. We need to get detailed information because what we're saying is makes an impact in terms of what you think and what the public is hearing on the FFC side. So that we're pushing it. On the issue of consequence management and penalties, I think the first thing that I would like to say is the issue of the relationship, especially in the conditional grant and policy, there's a relationship between the principal and agent. And sometimes there are multiple principals. And in this instance I'm talking about, there might be two or three departments that also that act as a principal. For example, on the grant that deals with municipalities, there's the treasury is the overall principal, right? And then there's also the Department of Costa that's the principal. And then there's obviously sometimes the provincial departments that plays a role in that. And many a time there's a shirking of responsibilities between the treasury, the Department of COCTA, or the provincial department, especially when things go wrong. When things go right, everybody takes the credit for it. So there's a need to look at what is the conditional grant framework is saying, and whether that framework is putting enough rules and regulations in place for performance. And that's a critical thing. So on the consequence issue of this, there is a conditional grant framework because when the division of revenue gets approved by both houses, it's the law. So that's the one measure, standard of measure to determine whether there's a performance and what are the penalties to it. And obviously the conditional grant, I don't talk about the penalties, but you have the PFMA, you have the Public Service Act. And obviously if there's fraud and corruption, there's the anti-corruption laws that we have in the country that can deal with that. And in some instances, there's a need to track. The clever thing that's happening in certain provinces, which I will not mention, is that they sometimes spend very fast on their conditional grant, and later use the equitable share allocation. Because the equitable share allocation is their own money. So they rather spend national money first. And sometimes there are interconnections between programs. For example, if you spend on a particular matter in health, which has got consequences for social development and nutrition and that. So they will use that money to spend for it and use their own money later to do that. So there's also a tracking thing that needs to happen around that. But on the oversight...
Chair, could you give me a round up?
Is it a round up on everything? On the proposal?
I know you've got other members.
Okay. Can I also make this point on the... Yeah, this is always a problem that we have with the agency when we come here.
You're still wasting your time.
On the revenue collection in municipalities, I think there's a big problem on invoicing, debt collection, costing and pricing of goods and services, poverty levels you'll find in these municipalities. and also the knock-on effect on households. On the issue of SOEs, there's the issue is that for now we can't actually give a firm view on the SOEs with regard to the financial and fiscal viability, because we need to know what is the costing and pricing of infrastructure within those SOEs. What is the government guarantee? What are the consequences of those government guarantees on the overall fiscus? What is the loan repayment arrangement? What is the framework for agreeing to those government guarantees? But also, what is the domestic debt register of these institutions? Because ESCOM has got a debt register, we want to see how that compares with ESCOM then approaching the markets. Can I hand over to Shane quickly, Chairperson?
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Okay, so I'm responding to page 6, the third dash point. Public investment growth contributions slow from 0.3 at the beginning to of the same year to 0.1. Just to inform the members, in terms of investment, specifically looking at things like machinery, equipment, and construction. So I can give you three wholeheartedly reasons for why public investment, in particular, that slow during the period under review, and that is that overall sort of fiscal consolidation momentum that was built during that time, and the two is that as we've seen always public expenditure on a whole is that COE first, investment later, and then the third, I think going forward, just to maybe prop this going forward, is that there is a going fiscal shift through the restructuring and reorganization of the SOEs, but that is so investment turning to restructuring and reorganizing of the SOE, but that is to improve governance, obviously, going forward.
The question about conditional grant readjustment impact, and the question about whether the campaign is issued. The point that we make in the October is when these adjustments are made, there is usually protection for projects which have already been completed. But oftentimes municipalities don't pay on a 1 year basis. They pay on a 3 year basis. So in the IDP processes, municipalities would have identified projects which are going to be implemented in the third year of the IDP process. So when you cut the conditional grant, obviously you may protect those projects which have been committed. But in terms of municipal, the credibility of the municipality, ensuring that they carry through with the projects that have already been planned in the IDP, they need to look for that. So yes, there is serious sampling off with the delivery plans when the reduction started. Unfortunately, this is a very quite a difficult problem because we're sitting in a situation where conditional grants are not performing, and when conditional grants are not performing, you've got to reprioritize expenditures to areas where there is good expenditure. Part of the problem that we have noted in the previous period was that prior to conditional grants being introduced, there must be sufficient preparation to ensure that when the conditional grant kicks in, so there's sufficient capacity to deliver this, to spend on those conditional grants, but that is not being done. We still find that a conditional grant is introduced in this year, and municipality is expected to be ready the following year to implement that conditional grant. And obviously, and this again coincides with the question that was raised about the 1 year pilot period. So our experience has indicated that it takes about 3 to 5 years for a conditional grant to start really performing well. So if you're just only going to introduce a 1 year pilot period, it's not sufficient for you to assess whether there's sufficient or there is good performance on that conditional grant. So you need to give it about 3 years or so for an assessment. So that's why we think the 1 year pilot period for us is not sufficient. The issue of 7.4% on social protection, of course, I mean, we would love to see much more increase on the child support grant, but unfortunately, with the current budget, the current economic situation, we still think that 7.4% is sufficient at least to cover the inflation. But also again, is also there is a need to see, not to see the social protection allocation not in isolation from other social wage programs. So we've got the RTP programs, we've got free basic education programs. So those programs need to be viewed holistically as part of the government social package. So that means taxation provides a cushion, even though the social grant is not growing as much as other grants, you still have a little bit of cushion from your other programs which are targeted at the children. The transition, the issue of who must take, must be responsible for oversight when the conditional grants are being incorporated into the provincial budget. This issue is related to the question that was answered by the chairperson on accountability. In this case, the relevant authority would be the provincial department of social development. But as we may have seen, we've got a serious accountability delivery chain problem in the country, especially when we look at the relationship between parliament and the executive, as well as the relationship between the executive and the provincial and the provinces, where the province has to account to the executive, the premier has to, the MEC has to account to the provincial legislature, and the MEC must also hold local government accountable. That whole accountability chain is actually very problematic, and the problem is much more structural, and it needs to be re-looked. The question of which conditional grants should not have been cut from our perspective. Obviously, we do agree with the fact that underperforming conditional grants have got to be cut. Yes, that is it's a principle. But as I said, is that as and when you do that cutting of conditional grants, you must take into consideration the fact that you may be undermining some of the policies, the national policy objectives. So if we have set out a target of delivering 13 houses over a certain period of time, and you have a cut on a conditional grant, we must also accept that with that cutting, you're putting that the target at risk. The grant which would have liked to see not being cut would be the human settlement development grant. So when you make an assessment of what, despite saying that the grant has not been performing well, but when you look at the expenditure performance grant over the years, it has almost been over just about 99% or so. So in our, from our view, the grant has actually been performing well. But on the other hand, what you see is that the input costs associated with the built environment are actually growing much faster than the rate at which the grant is growing. So now with the cutting, it simply means that the outcomes that are associated with the HSCC grant are not going to be even be smaller and smaller. And we have seen the pressure coming from the metros complaining that in certain instances, because of this cap, they have to go into the community and build houses for only one section of the community and not the rest of the community. And that creates social tension, because you cannot be seen to be addressing only the need of one of the whole community, but only addressing part and not addressing the whole. So that would be. As well, the question around this is the basic nature of the transfer. When you look at the provincial equitable share transfer, if you look at the province which receives the highest allocation, it would be your heart, and this is in respect of the capital allocation, so an allocation per population. It would be the Eastern Cape, Limpopo, and KZN. So those would be, but what we've seen over time is that poverty is now a benign. We're starting to see high poverty levels in Gauteng, because people who are poor, people who are unemployed, they move to Gauteng looking for jobs. And as a result, poverty is moving with them. And Gauteng is interestingly showing that they're receiving more of the TS allocation than the rest of the other poor provinces. But that is only, that is just a reflection of the migration pattern within the country. But the provincial equitable share formula in itself is still very much critical. And that also applies even
with
the local government.
Taking that FSC is done, we'll now move over to Sada.
Mm-hmm.
Any additional responses from FSC? Okay. Let's move over to Fatah. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm just going to respond to one two questions that raised by Honorable Manana. The rest, the managers will deal with that. Honorable Manana, the issue that you indicated to me in our previous meeting, it was taken up. I raised it in our PEC meeting. But the outcome was that the relevant committee must deal with the issue so that they can have the full report. Because what we informed to say others are paying and others are not paying, as you indicated. So bear with me, I will actually give you a full report, because if it's not resolved, we have to take the matter up with our NEC. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Councillor. Chair, I'm going to attempt to answer the questions where I have not addressed anything. My colleague Komoso will also assist me. On the issue of revenue collection rate decline, as well as a mechanism to improve on that, as well as on government debt, what we have found to be a problem as far as is the implementation of credit control and debt management policies in municipalities, and the enforcement of these policies through bylaws. So if we can overcome that, we believe that the collection rate on revenue will increase or will improve. And also, Chair, you would recall that the President mentioned in the State of the Nation address that there is a culture of non-payment in general. So we as well have embarked on a payment campaign in collaboration with COFTA and National Treasury to try and encourage payment of municipal services. Regarding my councillor has addressed the billing system, and on which municipalities are the 40 municipalities, honourable member, we will provide that list to the committee. And also, Chair, maybe to go back to the Honourable Councillor from Free State, we take note of the notion that we go back and assess how smaller municipalities managed their finances in the past, also considering the realities facing local government currently. We really appreciate that and acknowledge the recommendation. Regarding the report of our study on local government equitable share review, Chair, the study has just been finalized, so it has not been distributed to our counterparts at National Treasury. However, it was tabled to our National Working Group, who gave us the blessing to come and present it to this honorable committee. However, as soon as it goes through the relevant structures within SALGA, it will be made available to the committee as well. In terms of the unfunded mandate, what will it take to correct the matter? I think clear powers and functions, as the honourable member has indicated, the confusion and elaborated how the confusion is perceived. I think the correct view of SALGA in that regard. So we believe that clear powers and functions will correct this matter. And on unpredictable funding. I guess it's the wording. Maybe we need to correct the wording on how we put our statement there. We acknowledge that, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and Honourable Councillors, and all the input and the questions raised. Just in addition to my colleague, underfunded mandates. To be specific also on health services, especially when my colleague was commenting on slide 9 that we are having a serious challenge, especially where you find that there are salary gaps from one municipality to another, that you see that your staff will move because another area is, they can afford them better salary packages, and which leaves a gap. It will also apply to library services. So this causes a lot of instability within the sector. Now, also in addition to your powers and functions, this has there's a review that was supposed to be submitted by COCTA, so the feedback is not yet back. So we'd appreciate if COCTA can, you know, speed up the process so that we can also have a look at the outcomes of that review. And then one of the impact on your powers and functions relate to issues of spatial planning and in terms of your district, your locals, and including your traditional leaders, which causes a lot of confusion, especially when it comes to revenue collection, to say who are the main role players within the space. And this causes a decline within the sector. Now, in addition also to the declining revenue, is that we have noted that most of our households cannot afford, because there has been a lot of economic changes. Some of the mines closed, and some of the steel industry closed down. And also in areas where Eskom is directly providing services, where municipalities are unable to collect and to implement debt and credit control policies. As a proposal, we, as my colleague has said, that we've been tasked, National Treasury, SAGA, COCTA, to come up with ways in terms of how we can also assist municipalities in improving their revenue. One of them is to come up with a proposal to say, let's look into installation of the use of smart metering for both water and electricity. This will assist both your household, your commercial, to take ownership in terms of their consumption. It will also assist the municipality to get the revenue on time and in advance, because you will have to pay for what you're consuming. So it gives municipality power also, and it also gives the national government to actually compare within the same systems used by your prepaid metering, and to measure our consumption, and to predict the future in terms of the demand and the supply within both water and electricity. And another question that was raised on the burden or the overburden in terms of reporting compliance. Yes, we acknowledge that the accountability is needed and is necessary, and we advocate for that. But now the challenge is that our councillor has mentioned, our honourable councillor has mentioned that if now it has a direct increase or burden on the operating costs, then it's no longer now your daily operating. It means you need more manpower, more resources in order to effect the service. Because now the challenge is different sectors, they require different reports at different intervals. So we are proposing that, to look into the entire reporting framework to say, is it workable? Does it add value to our members? Does it add value to our community? And what kind of information do we really want to see? And if that information is credible and it will be user-friendly as well. So that we don't overburden our municipalities with the same report now with different designs and also different timing. I think most of the questions were answered by my colleague, and then we thank you.
Okay, before 1:30 we are left with 20 minutes. I would like to allow, let's take 10 minutes for follow-up questions and also if there are new questions. But please help me on this one. Let's be short and to the point so that we can then allow them another 10 minutes to respond to those questions. I'm saying this because most members have indicated that they would like to try and catch their flight, and they'd be happy if they can be here by 1:30 or 1:30.
Yeah.
All right. Honourable Member Shepherd Toilet. Okay, you know what I'm going to do in this second round? I'll allow you each one. If you've got more questions, can you please submit them to our secretary in writing so that he can then forward them to the relevant stakeholders for their written responses. Please. Thank you very much. Honourable Member Shopestole, how many would like to talk on this one? Honourable Member Shopestole, Honourable Member, yes.
I just want to ask a question.
No.
She actually left something out there. It's comparative. So can we first allow her to present that, because maybe it's going to be a follow-up question later. Thank you.
Okay, let's give a chance to respond to that one. But Madam, if you can be short and to the point.
Thank you, Chair. It's very short. It's just to mention that we are doing a study with UJ regarding the feasibility of municipalities being able to provide electricity on their own when we say removing ESCOM from the municipal electricity distribution market. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Honourable Member Shopper's Toilet and Honourable Member, please remind me, Honourable Member, number two. Come again. Okay. So we have the two and then yourself. And then we give the eight.
Yeah.
In that order?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make another request to the FHC that they look at the possibility of a concerted effort of training a municipality on budgeting, because you know, at the back of my mind, when people say they unspent funds which treasury takes back, I get worried because I come from a rural area. I know there's a lot of lack of skills, and I'm just imagining that if it is a fund to repair our roads. My road is very bad, and if that money is taken off because of whatever reason, it is the communities that suffer. It is not the people who fail to spend that suffer. So I would like a discussion between the FSC and Treasury to look at another way of doing things, but also to empower the local government on budgetary, how to budget, because the constitution emphasized that it is the responsibility of the national and the provincial sphere to assist local government, not to penalize local government. You know, we don't want penalties. It's a conflict of deliver.
Okay, and in response to this one, SALGA must also tell us about their success in training people in local government, in empowering them, because there is a budget earmarked
for training. So their success rate in training, because regardless of their training, this is what we are stuck with. Municipalities not being able, you know, failing on financial management, on project management, you know, a long whole list of things that is happening at the municipal level. Thank you very much. Honourable Member number two.
Chairman, the question in terms of MIC being utilized for anything of the and we cannot justify that currently the municipalities are using municipal infrastructure bank for any other thing, therefore to define the demand condition. That's my argument. It was introduced for municipalities, especially the smaller ones, who were trying to help them to say, because you are unable to do this, that must be the top. I still need that test. What is meant by MIC being allowed to be utilized for any other nature? My argument is that your equitable share in very small municipalities is meant for your balance and any other thing, even the business demand. Now, what is it that we are trying to say MIC must be utilized for any other thing? My last issue, Chair, I just think that my last issue, Chair, let's not. All of us, we have an as Chairperson has been saying today, all of us, we have to play our oversight role, Chairperson. Your Section 71 report, Section 72 report, one Section 130 of the MSMS is very clear in terms of what you have meant to do. I think we must not shift us and want to hide behind that local government's opportunity. Because MFMA, it stipulates clearly who is supposed to do what at what time and anytime. Now, let's not want to take any other piece of legislation and want to say we are open to the local, because that's going to create a problem. Whereby the other issue check, we cannot expect communities to preserve in other instances, then your leaders in the municipalities are the ones that are going to. You can't expect. And I still argue. Let's move on to say 80% of communities are unable to do, because that's where it tells check and if you've got about 80% of indigents, then therefore the equitable share will cater for that and 20% must be. So let's go back and deal with the issue of credit control. SAGA must make that to play a vital role in this policy. That's the only thing that I wanted to start with. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Co-Chair. A case study referring to reporting and alignment of reporting is our Tambo District Municipality in the Eastern Cape, where the NCOP were requested to assist to let money be released by the National Treasury that was withheld, taken back, 90 million rand. And one of the serious matters issues was reporting. Reporting to the National Treasury, report to the Department of Commerce, and figures didn't match up. And that's where the alignment was. And that was our recommendation when they appeared before us in Parliament with all the relevant departments and MECs, and when we went there to do our on-site oversight. So that point must be implemented, because there was agreement. There must be alignment. Now it seems to me, and we will check on it, this is a matter that we must look at. The last one, Co-Chair, the University of Wits did a study on the success of interventions. That study, and to the staff, must be dealt with in Parliament as well. Maybe a day conference on interventions, etc. I'm just thinking aloud, but we can't leave it there. It's there. Study was done. What now? How can we improve in terms of what was raised here? Thank you, Chair.
OK.
Okay, just the last one. I hope you're repeating what I've already asked. The presentation speaks about the 128 municipalities which are in financial distress since the end of 2016. According to National Treasury State of Local Government report, about 145 municipalities achieved unqualified audits in 2016-17, which was noted by AXA as a continual deterioration, and 40 municipalities with negative cash balances. If Salda can share with us on what is being done to turn this situation around, because much as you are advocating for an increase in terms of the equitable share, allocation of the equitable share, but there's this situation where if more money is put in there, we will still not be able to achieve the quality life of the people that we have promised as government through your service delivery, through the local government service delivery. And then we would also like National Treasury to also comment, I'm sure you would find an anger, and then we really want to hear from you in this discussion. Over to, we'll start with FFC. Over to you, Chair. No follow-up questions on FFC. No, Mr. Lucy, you are being defensive. All right. Over to Salda.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, with regard to the MID being used in any other area, I think the presentation says in any other area of the municipality, but mostly we encourage that it be increased to, or it may be used for maintenance and to maintain our infrastructure. If you go back to slide 6, where we talk about the shortfall or the underfunding of local government, the 35 billion there is attributable to operating expenditure, and one of the areas is maintenance deficit, honorable member. So I guess the case that we are trying to drive home is that if MIG could be used or could be flexible enough to also cater for maintenance of infrastructure assets. Thank you, Honourable Member. In terms of what is being done to address the situation, Chair, implementation is one area that we struggle with, implementation of policies, as I mentioned, and mostly in supply chain management. So I believe that's also one other area that we as Southern need to capacitate our members on, and also coming back to training, which you have indicated. But we will provide a report to the committee in terms of the success rate in that regard, in terms of training, that is. I don't know if I have left anything for that.
What is it that you're doing to turn the situation around in the municipalities? Because you want more money. But when you look at the situation, also the situational analysis, we're not sure if that money will be for good use, if this is the status quo at a municipal level. I touched on the 125 municipalities, which are in financial distress. Must know financial distress, people can analyze this, and it comes from a lot of things. Irregular expenditure, unauthorized expenditure, wasteful expenditure, expansion and deviations on your procurement processes. So what is it that you are doing to assist them?
Can I come in here?
Mm.
Calgary is conducting workshops year on year. 100% fine. When the attendees go back to their municipality, they're supposed to implement what they were taught. But then the AG come up with his report and say, but this is how you look like. Now somewhere something went wrong between the workshop and the implementation in the municipality. That must be corrected. And one thing to do, to try and correct it, before they go home, let them write a test. Test them. Did they understand what they were taught? Give them an assignment. You go, you're not leaving this venue until you pass this subject. Yes. Except if you got another magic way to do it. But the point is, we have to turn it around. Part of the back to basics program. Sorry. Thank you.
Okay. Follow-up question.
I just have
to check if you haven't forgotten the other presenter that you mentioned.
Vanessa.
No, I haven't. Remember, I did ask a question. So, if she wants to respond, I'll see that by, you know, indication of.
I'll try to do it.
Okay. Let's allow her to finish and then we'll come to you in the National Treasure. Thank you very much. Is there any other response? I could ask you or. No. FFC, as long as I shot into the point. Okay. No. Finish your response.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honorable Chair, for the recommendation to test the trainees, and we'll take it to the office for implementation. And also, just to go back to my slide 6, where we're talking about restructuring the short learning program, which is something that will also assist in developing some local government agenda. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. We'll appreciate if you can also, if you can just share with us your oversight too. Okay. Over to you, madam.
Thank you. In response to the honourable member's question, we are an NGO. We form a network for 220 members. Now, of those 220 members, we have 72 special care centres who are members. Excuse me, and we have about 2,300 children in these centres. I need to make it clear that we do not fund the centres, we do not manage them, nor monitor them. Our role is to provide a network for them. GSD and Department of Health do it to some extent in accord with the TBA and CSLA. Then in terms of the pilot in that I suggested in Western Cape and Gauteng, the feed funds of four provinces were withheld and they were, sorry, the unspent funds returned to Treasury and funds for the next year were withheld from them. So we are saying, could we not use those unspent funds to pilot an implementation of the court's order? And I suggested the Western Cape and Gauteng and gave my reasons. In terms of the special school teachers, I made reference to that on slide 14. So Dora B2 2018, page 133, says that teachers at special schools had to be trained to teach the children at special care centres and they have to provide outreach services to train and support teachers and learners at the special care centres. That isn't happening. And then in terms of DSD, the Department of Social Development in the Western Cape is in fact has taken the lead in the implementation of the court order in the absence of leadership from WCD in the matter. So if you go to slide 8, you will see the breakdown of the funding that DSD in the Western Cape and Department of Health in the Western Cape provide directly to centres. They are contributions for staff salaries, for transport, for per capita funding for donors, but they are contributions. They in no way can be compared to the DBT per capita grant for learners at special schools, which is where these children should be. And then, Honourable Chair, I am grateful that you have directed us to make submissions, although that will be in a year's time only, unless we do it at the medium term October budget presentations as well. And I think I learn every day in this job. It's not where I started out. And then, Honourable Chair, I think you asked me about the other provinces that referred to. So firstly, I wasn't sure whether you meant which provinces did not spend their funds. They were the Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, Limpopo, and Northwest. So we are partnering nationally with South African Federation for Mental Health and specifically with the Mpumalanga Society for Mental Health. But in addition to that, we got the call from the Eastern Cape about the centres that were unfunded, where the court order was not being implemented, even though the department had now come to them, this is of education, to say that they were implementing the court order. I think that answered all the questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Over to, let's have FSC and then National Treasure.
Thank you, Chair. I will be quick and sorry for missing the last opportunity. I think what is important is that life in a local municipality is not easy. I think we sometimes, because we always look through our city lenses in terms of metros, we treat the other, we think that the other municipalities must be the same. It's not the same. The purchasing of goods and services, electricity and water, I doubt whether there's a differential in pricing between what a municipality, what a metro will pay, a city will pay for electricity, relative to what a local municipality will pay for electricity. It was really about the infrastructure investments that needs to be made and passed through cost. The cost gets shifted. Because state-owned enterprises that sell these things are sometimes having an asymmetry of information between themselves and a particular local government municipality. And it has shown in terms of the costing and pricing of how energy gets, electricity gets purchased and how it gets then sold by municipalities to their own households and institutions within the municipality. What complicates the matter is that in local municipality there are huge pockets, an extent of pockets, of stubborn poverty. Stubborn poverty to the extent where there's no disposable income, to the extent there's no revenue that really can be collected because many of the people are unemployed. We have ghost towns where mines and others have been moved out. And there's no social responsibility that we forcing those institutions that have actually extracted some of these minerals to come back and reinvest in those communities. So we have ghost towns. So as a result, there is a fiscal gap. There's a gap between what is the mandate of that local municipality and what is the revenue that local municipality must collect from its people Because it can't collect from these people, because if there's nothing, there's nothing. It doesn't matter how you look at zero. Left, right, center, up, upside down, it will remain zero. So that's the problem that we have in local municipalities. So I think going forward, there is a need to rethink the whole question of municipalities. Do we need 257 municipalities? In fact, do we need those municipalities? That's a coordinator between local municipalities. It's just a thing that we need to rethink. And I'm actually happy that that the president has did raise that there's a need to relook at the macro organization of the state. And I hope it's also going to be, there will be no holy cows in the whole reorganization, whether it's state-owned enterprises, to provinces, to the number of municipalities that we have. I mean, 55 million people. Do we need 257 municipalities? And also the provinces. So I thought that's just an important point to make, because in these municipalities get a conditional grant, and the conditional grant goes straight to pay ESCOM. Because if they don't pay ESCOM, the last case will cut off, and there are huge consequences. Thank you, Jane.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm sure National Treasury listened carefully to this input for your consideration. Right. But also, Chair of FSC, I think these inputs should also make at a budget council level or budget forum level. In your engagement with National Treasury, so the National Treasury can interrogate the input for its deeper understanding and for their further consideration.
There will be a Lahotla after the elections in National Treasury. It happens every election. After elections, there's a Lahotla again. The FSC will be part of that, as far as I know. We will check on it.
We're going to allow
a quick chair.
A dialogue in the I think we've made our point. I'm sure we've made that.
Thank you, Chair. I think we can add to the list of papers that the FFC can make the recommendation to the FFC's recommendations on the division of revenue for next year. Thank you for the opportunity to comment briefly. I'm aware that we're in extra time already, so I'm going to be as brief as I can. As Chair De Beer has mentioned, we will submit a list of short responses on Monday to facilitate the committee's work. So we'll cover all the kind of detailed responses in there. If I can just comment here, I think on three things where I think a response at the level of principles is helpful for the committee members as you reflect on this over the weekend. The one is there was both the FFC and SALGA made a number of comments about increasing flexibility in the use of grants. We've had quite an extensive back and forth around the NIG. And just on that, I mean, we need to balance things here. And I think you see that need for balance even in the FFC's recommendations, where in some places they're recommending greater flexibility in the use of grants, but in Chapter 6, they actually have a recommendation that we must be much stricter on enforcing grant conditions. And so, you know, there is that tension. So a grant like the NIG has tried to balance that by saying, look, it's up to the municipality to pick the individual projects from their IDP that are funded from the NIC, but it can only be used on infrastructure and only in these sectors and infrastructure that serves the poor. So that's how we kind of try to balance that. And if I can just say on increasing discretion and flexibility, you know, if you look at what's happened in the country over recent years, if you think of headline grabbers like the illegal deposits of grant funds that municipalities made into the VBS bank that my minister highlighted in his MTVBS speech, you know, it's hard to look at that kind of situation and say what we need is increased discretion for municipalities in grants. I think that there are cases where increased flexibility is helpful for municipalities. And that's why, from the Treasury side, we've really emphasized taking a differentiated approach. And the Integrated Urban Development Grant, which allows greater flexibility but only for a selection of municipalities that meet qualification criteria, and those qualification criteria include good governance measures. Those municipalities should have greater discretion. For other municipalities, there should be tighter monitoring, oversight, and support, and I think that's how we're trying to strike that balance. In a second issue, Salga made a number of comments about the local government white paper, and I think it's just worth reflecting that while Salga talked about a lot of other things that have changed in the 20 years since the white paper was published, they didn't discuss how the funding system has actually changed dramatically since the white paper was published. So they cite this figure in the white paper which says that 90% of local government budgets come from own revenue. But it states that as a matter of fact, that was the situation when you added up municipal budgets as best as the data was available in 1998. But the white paper itself says this will not remain the same. As the system evolves, this will change, and as we establish municipalities in rural areas, this will change. And in fact, that has changed. And in all of the Treasury presentations, we note that figure is now 70%, that the funding from transfers has gone from 10% to 30%. And that's in spite of the fact that electricity prices have increased dramatically, so that, you know, where you're recovering costs, you and me paying electricity bills, that number has doubled. So there really has been, we published a 20-year time series last year, there has been a dramatic change on the financing side. The Treasury, you know, I think the local government white paper set out a very useful set of principles, and I think it would be useful to have a discussion about whether those principles are still relevant, because I think the actual numbers there are not the numbers that we should be critiquing yet. And then just the last point on the suggestions around maintenance and that maintenance could be funded from the NIF. Salga and other stakeholders and municipalities generally are very keen to emphasize their ownership of municipal assets. And I think we must reflect on who should be accountable for the maintenance of assets that you own. If you're saying that we should fund the construction, the building of assets for municipal asset register, but then national government must then pay for the maintenance of those assets, who's really accountable for those assets, and in what sense are they owned by the municipality? So obviously the local government fiscal framework acknowledges that municipalities have revenue problems, that they can't, you know, as Professor Plankes was pointing out, you know, there are municipalities with very weak revenue bases. Those municipalities are compensated in the equitable share, and the equitable share funding does include provision for maintenance of assets, but it is up to municipalities to be accountable for prioritizing budgeting for that maintenance in their own budget. And if municipalities are going to be treated as a sphere of government that is the owner of assets, they must be accountable for taking care of those assets. We must make sure that the funding is available, but if we fund the building of the pipe and then the looking after of the pipe, then I think we're getting to the point, which is maybe where Professor Plankes is going, that maybe national government must just manage the whole thing and it mustn't be a local responsibility anymore. So I think we must just be very careful around that. I'll end there. I think on the two NGOs that presented, we'll write the comments. I think I really appreciate the depth that they went into.
Yeah.
The Division of Revenue Bill is 330 pages of detailed rules and instructions for how the system is supposed to be run, and it's a pleasure to see people engaging with that detail. I don't think we'll, by Monday morning, be able to give an adequate response on that, so we look forward to further engagement, I hope, but we will take those issues forward. Thank you.
Well, as we close, thank you very much, National Treasury. So you'll see you have a very important role also in this meeting, for bringing clarity on those issues where we need clarity, and also listening to the thinking and rethinking on the local government issues, provincial issues, you know, budget issues. I just would like, as we close, I would like to remind members that if they have further questions, that can submit those in writing to the secretary, who will know what to do with this question. But also, I know we've asked for a submission of a research report. I would like to put a time frame, because we also don't have time, any more time in this parliament as we're preparing for our way out. So we'd like to leave everything on the table. Your return date is the 12th of March. Remember, you're not going to write that report. You have it. Just submit. So we'll appreciate to get it on the 12th of March. And then, indeed, I would also like to thank all the stakeholders for taking their time to prepare and present before the two appropriations committee. We are pleased to see a growing interest in the affairs of Parliament. Public participation is the driving force behind the work of Parliament. It is our core business. So thank you very much for making us meet this requirement. National Treasury, we note the infusion of innovation in the 2019 conditional grant framework, and we are confident that this will help improve efficiency in spending and performance. But then I think this should be accompanied by close monitoring by National Treasury and also FALDA and also the committees that are represented here. Indeed, we agree that there is a need for greater oversight over provincial and municipal spending, and FALDA has a very big role to play in respect of local government. So if we can just rise, at least take this to new heights, your oversight role, take it to new heights, and we would like to see impact. This committee emphasizes impact on the expenditure of the taxpayer's money. Impact and value for money. We also agree that reductions and reprioritization should not impede service delivery, but spending entities should improve spending efficiency to avoid spending cuts on their budget. Because I know the emphasis is on the budget cuts, but it's not on what triggered the budget cuts. So if we can all play our role, you know, let's bring a balancing act, I think we will not have these problems that we are confronted with today. We also take note of the issues raised about the state of finance and performance in the education sector by the Equal Education and the Western Cape Forum for Intellectual Disability. Please rest assured that your submissions and comments have broadened our thinking, and we will carefully consider your input when we process our report on the 2019 Division of Revenue Bill. Our support staff will ensure that your input is carried over to the 6th Parliament. We just want to make sure that all those submissions reach us before our exit, so that we are reassured by our staff about their, you know, processing of that input and making sure that the work that we're doing here is not lost, but there is continuation in the 6th Parliament. Well, all our members, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. The meeting stands adjourned.
We got here.
Yes,
thank you. We see each other again next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday, yeah?
They're getting on that auditing.